Welcome to the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People with Dr. Stephen R. Covey. In this audio program, Stephen shows that effectiveness with ourselves and with others is based upon our individual character and not upon quick-fix formulas or manipulative techniques. He also teaches that we are not solely the product of our conditions, our upbringing, or our genetic makeup, but that the essential elements in long-term effectiveness, our habits, can be learned and deeply internalized. Stephen begins by identifying specific examples of results you can expect from living and applying the 7 habits and shares how to get the most out of this program.
I will be presenting 7 interrelated habits that highly effective people have internalized, habits that are part of their very nature. I'd like to give you an idea of what you can expect and also what you should do to meet these expectations. This is a life-changing program. I'm not using hyperbole. I'm not trying to exaggerate for effect. It is an absolute guarantee that if you will understand these habits, teach them to other people, and learn them well, and then apply, live them until they become part of your nature, it will change your life in a very fundamental way for good in these areas. 1, improved self-confidence, self-esteem. That will come largely out of a sense of better self-control. You're not victimized. You're not being controlled by circumstances. You are in control. 2, improved relationships. Many people have relationships that are deteriorating. They're broken. Or they're breaking. It may be with their loved ones at home. It may be in their businesses. To significantly improve the quality of our relationships is one of the major expectations. You can expect it. It will happen. Those first two expectations are very related to each other. The higher your self-confidence is, the more you will respect others and work well with them. The less their weaknesses will be empowered by your depending upon them, relating to those weaknesses. Never build your emotional life on the weaknesses of other people. By doing so, you empower their weaknesses to control you. You magnify them. You strengthen them. You enlarge them. 3, your capacity to influence others will be significantly enhanced, to motivate others. How would you like to see your kids do their jobs cheerfully without being reminded? How would you like to see your employees or other of your working associates willingly sense your need, respond to it, cooperate, creatively solve problems? A 4th area of expectation is the spirit of adventure and creativity and joy and zest and excitement and happiness. The spirit of seizing new opportunities, doing new things, of growth, of learning. These things are very, very exciting. These are the 4 basic areas I think you can expect dramatic, even in some cases, revolutionary results. But this is not a quick fix program. It is not based upon some technique or some instant revolution. It's an evolution. You have to pay the price. The price basically involves these things. Work very diligently to understand. Learn, in other words. Work with your mind to think deeply in sustained ways about this material. 2, teach it to other people. Shortly after you learn this material, teach it. By shortly, I mean within 24 to 48 hours. You simply will learn better when you teach. All of us have had that experience because your whole sense of responsibility is significantly increased. You know that you're expected to teach someone else or another group the same material that you're learning. It also will give you a sense of commitment to the material simply because you're making a statement when you teach this material. It socially commits you. And that's powerfully reinforcing to your own motivation to live the material, to live the principles, to cultivate the habits. I encourage a commitment to teach. And think right now who you're going to teach and when. Put it on your calendar. Put it into your schedule. Literally, plan to teach it. I would encourage 2 times. Once to your loved ones and once to your working associates. To others who you know would have an interest and you'd like to share this material with, you care about, people you like. But the most important activity, of course, is the doing, the applying, the living. Whenever we are enlightened about a correct principle, it is incumbent upon us to live it. That is the only basis on which we can receive further understanding of other principles, higher principles. That's the test of our integrity. Integrity basically is the value that we place upon ourselves. It's a test of our self-discipline. So those are the three basic activities: learning, teaching, doing, or living, applying the material. If you'll do those three things, this material will become part of the way you think. To use the computer metaphor, it will become part of the software of your head. And little by little, you'll find this material will become more and more yours, deeply internalized, and it will affect all those other areas that I identified up front that you can expect to have significant, even dramatic, kinds of improvements in. Self-respect, self-confidence, improved relationship with others, improved capacity to motivate, to influence, and a whole new level of zest and excitement and adventure and joy and happiness and creativity in your life. Now, in this presentation, I'm going to organize it into three parts. The first part will involve giving the overview. What do we mean by basic habits? What does effectiveness mean? The second part will deal with the seven habits themselves. And I will present them in three groups. Habits 1, 2, and 3 will be the first group. Habits 4, 5, and 6, the second group. And habit 7, the third group. I'll also spend some time on each habit. The third part will be the review, where we'll study the relationship which the habits have to each other and certain activities which will combine all of the habits at the same time. That will be a kind of summary part so that we can revisit the habits and get an overall larger conceptual understanding of these seven habits and how they relate to each other and to our own personal and organizational lives. I must say at this juncture that these basic habits, because they are internalized principles, apply as much to organizations, including family organizations and business organizations and professional organizations and so forth, as they do to individuals. They would apply to marriages, to dyads, to triads, to families, to public organizations, private organizations of every kind. These habits are generic habits. That means they're like common denominators. They apply everywhere. That's what principles do. They apply everywhere. Now, I'd like to return to the idea of teaching, why it is so powerful, and why, by the way, if you're parents and still have school-aged children at home, I would encourage you to have them teach you what they're learning in every one of their classes at least once a week, to teach the essence of what they're learning. In doing so, you can expect these results. It will be a meaningful bonding experience. You will genuinely be learning. How many of you could pass your kids' tests? You'll genuinely learn. Second, it will change the nature of the relationship. There'll be more of a sense of two human beings at an equal level. They become the teacher. You become the student. Third, they'll do much better in the classes that they don't like. They'll compensate for their natural disinterest in the subject or for the weaknesses of the teacher. Now, I'll tell you why these things will happen. You are changing your role from one of student or learner or participant in a personal and organization development experience to one of teacher. For instance, if you knew you were going to teach a large group of people tomorrow the same material I'm presenting today, would that affect your learning today? Dramatically. Why? Because you have a different role in your head. You have changed your role. Now, this is one of the most important things we want to emphasize. If you really want to significantly improve people's behavior, change people's pictures of their roles.
Stephen next defines what a paradigm is and how changing our paradigms or the ways we see the world can result in major improvements in our personal and organizational lives.
I'd like to use a scientific term for a moment to describe what I'm presenting. It's called paradigm. A paradigm is the way you see the world, the way you see the universe. The way you see your role is a paradigm. For instance, a friend of mine just a couple of days ago had been up all night delivering babies, and I called in the morning to see if I could pick up his son to join with my son to go to a parade. And he was telling me about the night's activities. I said, "What's it like? You've delivered hundreds of them now. Do you ever find it becoming routine?" He said, "Stephen, you have no idea how moving, how inspiring an experience it is." I said, "What are you most impressed with?" He said, If the father participated over time in preparing for the birth and was present during the last stages, it profoundly affects the way they think and feel. One of the deliveries this morning was a newborn of a father who was a macho football player. He, in all of our visits, was rather filled with himself, with his concerns, his time schedule, and his own world, his own way of thinking. He said, "This morning, I saw him picking up the phone and calling his parents and unable to speak. He was so moved, so overwhelmed. A new family unit was being formed. His role was changing from one of husband to one of father. He sees things differently. He will never be the same again. He could slip back if he's not careful. But his paradigm, at least for this morning, I'm using my language now, has shifted. And that will produce a dramatic, revolutionary change in his behavior and attitudes." That's what a paradigm shift is. In science, you'll find that every significant breakthrough was a break with. It was a break out of old ways of thinking. Einsteinian physics eclipsed Newtonian physics. It's a relativity paradigm. Remember what a paradigm is again? It is the way you see the world. It's like a map of the territory. The relativity paradigm had higher predictive and explanatory value than the clockwork paradigm of Newton. We could get to the moon on Newton, but could not understand the basic unit in the universe called the atom. Einstein made a very significant statement, which has relevance for us now. He said, "The significant problems we face cannot be solved at the same level of thinking we were at when we created them." Again, the significant problems we face cannot be solved at the same level of thinking we were at when we created them. In other words, the major problems cannot be approached with the thinking that created them. It requires a new level of thinking, a new paradigm. Take the field of medicine. Until the germ theory was developed, which was a better map of what was happening out there, a high percentage of the women would die in childbirth. They even preferred to be delivered by midwives because there was less childbirth deaths. No one could understand why. Men in the lines who were wounded in the army were dying more from the wounds, small wounds, than some of the major traumas on the front lines. As soon as the germ theory was developed by Semmelweis and others, a whole new paradigm, a new map, a better, improved way of understanding what was happening made dramatic, significant improvement. A whole different way of thinking. Study yourself. Study the way you see the world. In the last analysis, your head creates your world. I'll explain that in greater depth a little later. Let me give to you a recent paradigm shifting experience that I had, and I'd like you to share in this experience. I want you to work with your mind and empathize with this situation and see if you do not experience a paradigm shift, as did I. Now, I must give kind of the bottom line before I give you this experience. What I'm suggesting is, if you want to make small improvements in relationships, in organizations, in your families, your marriages, and in yourselves, then work on your behavior. Work on your attitudes. If you want to make major, significant, quantum-type improvements, change your paradigm. Change your way of thinking. Change your map. All right, now let me give you this experience and see if it does not happen to you as it did to me. It was a Sunday morning in New York. I was on a subway alone. It was a rather quiet morning. The subway was no more than perhaps a third filled, very unlike, I'm sure, the raucous night before. People were just quietly sitting there, and some were reading their newspapers. It's kind of a pleasant, quiet morning. Now empathize, project your consciousness into this scene. All of a sudden, a man and his children, large group of children, got onto the subway. And they were so loud and so noisy, so raucous, that instantly the whole climate had changed. The man sat right next to me and did nothing about this whole situation. Everybody was yelling back and forth, throwing things, even grabbing people's papers. I mean, it was very disturbing. The man next to me did nothing. You're sitting next to him, and you witness this, disturbing everybody. How irritating, how upsetting. So I turned to him after a few minutes and said, "Sir, your children are really disturbing a lot of people. I wonder if you couldn't control them a little more." And he was looking down, kind of lifted his gaze as if to come to a consciousness of the situation, and said, "Oh, I guess I should. We just came from the hospital, and their mother just died about an hour ago. And I guess I don't know what to think, and I guess they don't know how to handle it either. Now, do you see that situation differently? I did instantly, as you do. You have a different map. Notice how free, flowing, and spontaneous your attitudes of helpfulness and sympathy are. Notice how your behavior flows from that. I said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. Your wife just passed away." He was almost beside himself. "What can I do to help?" See, I wanted to. Look how your attitude and your behavior are a function of your paradigm, of how you see the situation. Up to that point, I was forcing myself to give him this feedback in a fairly pleasant but direct way, when really inside I was getting increasingly upset that he would be so insensitive as to see his kids just running wild around there and him doing nothing about it, taking no responsibility at all. But the whole situation changed, as it does with you right now. You'd want to help him, and that involved doing some other things. But you'd want to. You could feel the sympathy and the plight, the misery of another human being with his family. And he was almost incapable of coping with such a major thing that had happened. You see, in a sense, the key to our circumstances and our lives is to think about the lens of our glasses, our paradigms, our maps that we're looking through, and to perhaps change our paradigm, our role, to reframe the whole situation so that you can interpret it in a new light. It isn't what happens to us that affects our behavior. It's our interpretation of what happens to us. And if we can learn to get a better map, a better paradigm, get at a different level of thinking, we are on the road to significant improvement. My friends, these seven basic habits represent, each one, a paradigm shift from the traditional way of thinking, from the popular patterns in society. Each one of them. I think you'll discover that as we go through this presentation. And I will make it explicit near the end of the presentation in part three when we review what we have covered.
Stephen next defines what a habit is and discusses how we can break away from old habits and become empowered to learn new habits of effectiveness.
Now let's take a minute to define what a habit is, because we're talking here about seven basic habits. A habit is an internalized principle, particularly if it's a habit of effectiveness. You've got a natural law we sometimes call a principle that makes sense. For instance, in business, a principle would be to value the customer and to adapt your whole approach in business to the customer. That's a principle. If I've internalized that principle to where I know how to do that, and I want to do it, and I know what to do, that's a habit. So the habit is the overlapping of knowledge, skill, and attitude. Knowledge is what to do. Skill is how to do. Attitude is why to do, or you could say want to do. See, I may know how to treat the customer with value to build that relationship. I may know what I should do, but not want to, because I may not feel like I'm treated that way. So it won't be a habit. In another case, I may know what to do to build my relationship with this teenager who's going through this terrific identity crisis and feels alienated from his parents, from the family. I may want to do it, know what to do, but not know how to do it. I don't have the skill. So if I lack the skill, it's not a habit. I might even have certain skill and knowledge, but not want to. A habit is the overlapping of what to do or knowledge, how to do or skill, and why to do, want to do or attitude. Where they overlap, you'll see a habit. Horace Mann, the great educator, once said, "Habits are like a cable. We weave a strand of it every day, and soon it cannot be broken." I don't personally buy the last expression. I know that they can be broken because habits can be learned and unlearned, and new habits can be learned. We'll go into that when we discuss habit number one. However, the first part of Horace Mann's statement is so true. People gradually develop a way of thinking, a paradigm, if you will, and also a kind of lifestyle that they are reinforced by in various ways. They have certain kinds of satisfactions, even psychological satisfactions, even though they realize the habit is not a fruitful habit. Nevertheless, it's deep inside them, and it has its play upon their life. So to overcome a habit involves a process and a tremendous commitment. It's almost like the Apollo moon trips put on by NASA many years ago. They had to literally break out of the tremendous gravity pull of the Earth and also the atmosphere surrounding the Earth. And most of the energy that was spent on those fantastic scientific adventures was spent in the first few seconds, even though those moon rockets went over 500,000 miles to the moon and back. But once they were out of the pull of gravity of the Earth, like habits are, gravity, pull us, and out of the atmosphere, the environment that our heads have helped create, they had an amazing level of freedom. In fact, one of the astronauts was interviewed and was asked the question, what was it like for the lunar module and the command module to separate and for the lunar module to go down to the moon? And he answered through breathing. And the reporter pressed him, what do you mean? He said, it is like the breath of a baby, the amount of freedom that he had, because he was not held down by gravity or by atmosphere. But the breaking of the habit, the breaking out of the Earth and pulling away from that gravity and that atmosphere requires a level of commitment, a sitting down, a counting of the cost to pay the price. But once it's done, you and I can experience the exhilarating kind of freedom that that little NASA metaphor bespeaks. I'll tell you, however, one of the problems with my reasoning here. Most people tend to be into quick fix. In fact, many of the very popular products give quick promises of relief. But the problem is that they work only on acute things. What's an acute illness physically? It is where there's some pain. The chronic illness, like the great mass of the iceberg, is the persistent, continuing disease which lies under the acute pain. Most people are into solving acute illnesses. They want the pain to be relieved. They want the relationship to be instantly corrected, solved. Seriously. They're into nostrums, quick fixes. They want to deal with acute illnesses. The problem is, the more you look for quick fixes, and the more you attempt to apply some gimmick, some technique that seemed to work for someone else, or that seems to have such an instant appeal to you, the worse the chronic problem becomes. For instance, if I am chronically fatigued, where my reserve capacities have gone because my working style has put me into a situation of management by crisis all the time, and I'm always overexerting or pressing myself to do far more than I should do, or where my emotional life is a function of other people's opinions of me to the point that I'm always trying to become all things to all people, or where I'm just literally stressed out of my gourd one way or another and the reserve capacities tend to break down, I could develop a chronic case, maybe of mononucleosis or other kinds of diseases. And that would manifest itself in certain symptoms. And I might look for quick solutions, quick answers. But it is illusionary. It's deceptive. Do not believe in quick fix. The only way you can bring the harvest in the fall is to plant in the spring, and to water, and to weed, and to cultivate, and fertilize during the summer. However, when it comes to social systems, people have learned quick fixes. How many of us crammed in school? How many of us got by cramming, got grades, got degrees even? And yet inwardly we know we didn't get a good solid education because we did not really pay the price day in and day out in our thinking processes, our daily preparations. We know it. And if we're hurt in some way, we work on that immediate hurt, try to solve the situation. Then another problem breaks out somewhere else, we run to that. You see, that's the kind of lifestyle that breaks people down and fatigues them, burns them out. Then their whole emotional capacity to relate well with others, particularly under stress and pressure, is reduced almost to a minimum. And their life becomes almost an entire function of what's happening to them. They become victimized by it all. A while back, I visited with a friend of mine who is the head of surgery at a hospital. And I asked him if he'd allow me to visit some of the operations going on in the hospital. He did. We went to over 20 of them. I also visited an operation that he performed. In fact, assisted him. They gowned me and washed me. And I literally held the instrument that kept the chest wall open while he did this vascular operation, replacing three vessels. He had me actually feel those vessels. I could sense how stiff they were, how brittle they were, because they were filled with all of this plaque, this cholesterol substance that was occluding those arteries. And I said, why don't you just clean them out? He said, for a while, you can reverse the process, but after a while, Stephen, the plaque, the cholesterol, becomes the very content of the wall. And I said, well, if you have corrected these three places, is the man clear? He said, it's through his whole system. Feel this, feel this, feel this. He's got a chronic problem, a vascular problem. It's a heart disease problem. He's an exerciser. You can see some of the supplementary circulatory system that's been developed. But he doesn't want to change other aspects of his lifestyle. He's got a chronic problem. I'm only working on the three most acute things that might cause heart attacks or stroking because of the lack of oxygen flow to those parts of the body. In other words, my friends, these basic habits are basic. They're not seven optional habits. They are generic. They are foundational. They're fundamental. You'll find all truly effective people possess these habits. They work on the chronic problems and also upon opportunities. New exciting opportunities that can unleash, release the human energy, the human spirit, the creativity within us.
The seven habits are habits of effectiveness. Stephen next relates Aesop's fable of the goose and the golden egg to illustrate how consistent effectiveness is always achieved through a balance of the results we seek and the assets that produce these results.
Now let's define what we mean by effectiveness. We've just defined basic habits. What do we mean by effectiveness? It's a most interesting term. I'd like to give a very simple definition. I call it the PPC balance. The PPC balance. P stands for production of desired results. PC stands for production capability. To quickly illustrate, you'd like to have a clean house. You'd like your children's rooms to be clean, wouldn't you? That's the desired results. That's P, production of desired results. PC means that your child is committed to keep that room clean, cheerfully, without being reminded, bugged, supervised, cajoled, manipulated, threatened, beat up, carrot and sticked. That's PC. Now, you can get a clean room by doing it yourself. But what's happened to PC? What's happened to the asset, the person, the resource to clean the room? What's happened to that person's motivation, desire, habit patterns, skill, knowledge, and attitude combined into a habit? That's PC. That's production capability. So I suggest effectiveness is to get the clean room and to have the kind of relationship, atmosphere in the home where people want to do their own jobs on their own, cheerfully. I'm sure all of us have studied Aesop sometime in our life, have heard his fables. The one that I like using in teaching the PPC balance is the one about this very poor farmer who's really down on his luck, down in his spirit, and totally impoverished. He comes across his favorite goose. And to the side of it is a brilliant, glistening gold egg. He's thrilled, but then he realizes instantly, someone's tricked me, it's bogus, so he throws it into the bushes. Then on second thought, he says, well, what have I got to lose? And he tests it. He finds out it's pure gold. Can't believe this. This windfall, fortune. The next day, he finds another one and tests it. Again, pure gold. The next day, the same thing. On and on. Every day goes back. Soon he becomes so fabulously wealthy, he becomes also impatient. He didn't want to go back every day. He wants them all, and he wants them now. Out of his greediness, he lops off the head of that goose, reaches inside to get them all, only to find none. In all organizations, there's basically three resources or three assets: the physical, the financial, and the human. That's obviously true in a business, but it's also true in a family. How many here have ever had the experience of neglecting an appliance and found that it only lasted one season, like a lawnmower? How many have neglected the car, proper maintenance, proper feeding and caring for the goose, if you see what I mean, and found that the golden eggs started to go down? In fact, think about this. You're in business. You've been in charge of this machine. There's tremendous growth taking place in the business and a lot of upward mobility. You'd like to get promotions too, so you want to make a tremendous record, short-term record. You don't care about the long-term. What would you do? Right. Run it hard and fast as you could. No PC, right? No feeding the goose. No taking care of the goose, because you just want to just crank out those products. And you do. And you make a terrific showing. Your production goes higher and higher. Your costs are low because there's no maintenance. You have really moved from red ink to black ink. You've moved into profitability. So we promote you to the upper executive ranks so we can get access to your skill and talent and thinking. The next new person comes on board. By this time, because of a lack of PC, because of a lack of feeding and tending the goose, the machine begins to break down. This floor person looks inside and notices, calls for downtime. Costs go up, production goes down, profits shot back into red ink. Now, what do people say to you, the first supervisor of the machine, in the executive corridors the next day about your successor? What do they say? He's a loser. I have never seen such a clear case of how leadership can make a difference. As soon as you left, went down. What if I were a coach and I really wanted to produce an outstanding team? Short run. I'd give all my energies to my present players, no recruiting. And I put on a fantastic show. And I am lauded and applauded all over the place. And I leave. The next coach comes in the legacy that I had just left. No one knows that. All they know is we've moved into constant losses. You can apply this thinking to any field of endeavor you wish. For instance, take your finances. Have you ever confused interest and principal? Have you ever invaded the principal in order to live better? Used it as income? Start to eat away at the goose in order to live higher on the hog, to have the things you want? Is that effective? Eventually, the goose dies. There's no more golden eggs. Or take your marriage. Do you and I make constant deposits into that relationship, the most important relationship probably we will have in life, along with our children? Sometimes I call this the emotional bank account. The emotional bank account is like a financial bank account into which you make deposits and you can take withdrawals. And if you make many deposits into that relationship, the trust level goes higher and higher and the nature of the communication becomes very soft and gentle and instantaneous. How many have such a high emotional bank account with someone you can communicate with them almost without words? How many can even make mistakes in your communication and they'll correct for the mistakes and get the meaning? It happens. We all have that kind of a relationship with people. It doesn't take time to communicate. It takes time to build the emotional bank account, to build the trust level. When the trust level is high, when the emotional bank account is high, communication is easy, it's effortless, it's instantaneous, and it's effective. If the trust level is low, it makes no difference how eloquent we may be, how clear we may be, how skilled we are in communication technique. People will be reading between the lines. It's like walking into a minefield. You never know when one of those things might be hit and go off. The essence of relationships is the trust level, the emotional bank account. That's PC on relationships. That's the goose, the quality of the relationship in business, the quality of the relationship with the customer. How does the customer perceive your business, perceive your products and your services? Is there a high degree of trust toward the integrity of your advertising, of your claims? Do you come through again and again and again to where there's an extremely high emotional bank account? And the customer almost pulls through the channels, the products, you don't have to push at all, to a position where we could call customer insistence. In this very community, I remember many years ago, a restaurant that served a fantastic clam chowder. You could hardly get near the place in the middle of the day because people would line up to get the clam chowder and would even take some home for the evening. They'd reheat it. Great business. No one knew what was happening, but that business was sold. New owners came in an effort to improve the profitability, in an effort to get more golden eggs, they watered down the clam chowder. What do you think happened to profits for a month or two? Of course, they zoomed. They went up. Why? Because you cut costs. And market insistence, market preference was still there. But little by little, the goose was getting sick. People's expectations were not being met, and the emotional bank account started to go down because of these withdrawals. Until a position was reached where the place was almost emptied out. They tried to recover, but by that time, they had violated the integrity perception of their customers. No one knew what had happened inside, but everyone knew what had happened to them. So also in a business, we can be on people's backs to treat the customer well, but how do we treat that person? The key is to always treat the employee exactly as we would want them to treat our best customer. What if that were the paradigm? You treat a customer like a volunteer because that's what a customer is. You treat an employee, an associate, like a volunteer because they have to volunteer their best thinking, their best loyalty, enthusiasm. You can buy a person's back, but not their mind. You can buy a person's hand, but not their heart. That kind of dedication, commitment, and loyalty must be earned by taking care of the goose. rather than taking the short view of constantly letting the bottom line of the number of golden eggs govern all decisions, all behavior. You see how anti-quick fix this is? You see how long-term thinking this approach is? This is the essence of effectiveness. I'll tell you a very fast way to tell whether a business has a good PPC balance. How do they deal with customer problems? If the customer's problem is out of standard operating procedure and it kind of throws the business and you get an answer like, "I'm sorry, sir, that's our policy," you'll know it's out of whack. What is a problem? A production problem, a P problem, is a PC opportunity. If you want to start making big deposits into customers, treat their problems as being important and try to solve them. It's a PC opportunity, and out of it will come many future golden eggs. You'd like people of different departments to cease this contention, this wrangling, this interdepartmental rivalry, and to cooperate with each other, to understand each other's concern and paradigm, and to learn to creatively cooperate. Now, you might take a strong hand and go for the desired result, threaten, change some compensation system to get some desired result. But the basic spirit of those people has not changed. The PC, the production capability, has not been altered. It requires your constant attention to it. How do you create a culture inside that organization that values both the desired result and the preservation and enhancement of the assets that produce it, the people, the resources? How do you do that? You see, so many organizations are filled with interdepartmental rivalries. In fact, one of the shocking experiences I've had in my consulting and training work over the years is to realize a high percentage of the problems begin with the people at the very top. The nature of the relationship they have with each other often, if deteriorated, gets translated throughout the entire organization, like osmosis. It's diffused everywhere. Dag Hammarskjöld, the late Secretary General of the United Nations, made this brilliant statement. "It is more noble to give yourself completely to one individual than to labor diligently for the salvation of the masses." You see, a person could be very actively involved with many people, many worthy projects out there, 10, 12, 14 hours a day, 5, 6, 7 days a week, and not have a meaningful relationship with his own spouse, with his own business partner, with this teenage son who's going through terrific turmoil. And it will take more nobility of character in the form of humility, courage, empathy, respect, understanding, to do whatever's necessary to rebuild that one relationship. But the ironic thing is, it is in the rebuilding of the one that the power to deal with the many comes from. The key to the 99 is always the one, because everybody is a one. For instance, if you should see me, say, punishing somebody in a social way that you felt was totally unjustified, how do you know I won't do that to you? You're a one. The key to your family is that one child that tests your patience the most, that communicates eloquently the unconditional or the conditional character of your love. What if we could say to our loved ones, "My love for you is greater than anything you do that bugs me," and live it on a one-to-one basis? I have a habit of taking my kids on dates, and we plan these dates. We find that the anticipation of the date is as satisfying as the realization. So we think about it for a long period of time. I came to one of my daughters and said, "Honey, tonight's your night. What is your choice? What would you like to do?" "Well, Dad, that's okay." "No, really, what would you like to do?" "Well, what I want to do, you really don't want to do." "Well, really, honey, I want to do it. No matter what it is, it's yours." No, I know you don't. I know you don't want to do it. I want to go to Star Wars, and I know how much you don't like Star Wars. You slept during Star Wars. You don't like these fantasy-type movies. I know you don't. So that's okay, Dad. "No, honey, if that's what you'd like to do, I'd like to." "Dad, you're just trying to do your daddy thing. Don't worry about it. We don't always have to have this date." "By the way, Dad, do you know why you don't like Star Wars?" "Because you don't understand the philosophy and training of a Jedi Knight." I said, "What? What was that?" "You know the stuff you teach, Dad? That's the same things that go into the training of a Jedi Knight. Let's go to Star Wars." And we did. And she sat next to me and gave me the paradigm. And I became her student, her learner. We went to all three. It's totally fascinating. I could begin to see, out of a new paradigm, the whole way that a Jedi Knight's basic philosophy and training is manifested in different circumstances. That was not just a P experience, it was a PC experience. It was bonding in our relationship and very satisfying in its fruit. We got golden eggs, and also the quality of the relationship, the goose, was significantly fed.
Stephen continues his discussion of effectiveness by describing how we can improve the quality of our relationships by making constant deposits into the emotional bank account of others.
Let me briefly mention six ways of building the emotional bank account with people, all people, spouses, children, employees, customers, whoever. First, simple kindnesses, simple courtesies, if you will. Thank you. I appreciate that. How are you today? Some people can treat strangers at the door better than their own loved ones. They fake it a lot. Their private lives often are in shambles, and they act out their frustrations into the lives of their loved ones. And they are constantly taking small withdrawals. They're discourteous, unkind, insensitive, without understanding, sympathy. The opposite of this, of course, would be a withdrawal. Second, honesty, to just be an honest person. Third, the making and keeping of promises. Probably there's no more massive withdrawal than to give a person a promise that's important to them and not come through. Because the next time you make a promise, they won't believe it. Fourth, expectations, the managing of expectations. You will find the root cause of almost all relationship difficulties, breakdowns, come from conflicting expectations surrounding roles and goals. Think of what I just said, that almost all, I've even heard some people claim all, broken relationships come from conflicting role and goal expectations. You said you, I never said that. No, my agreement was, oh no, I heard you very clearly. I never said that. What I said was, you said your role was, oh, that's not my role, that's your role. I was waiting on your, oh no, you told me to just do what you told me to do. I expected you to think on your own. We've got to accommodate this customer. Your role is to take some initiative. Last time I took initiative, I got shot out of the saddle. That's not my role. You say you want creativity and innovation, but I find you reward lockstep and conformity. Fifth, loyalty. Loyalty. Watch this. Let's say that the two of us are talking about him, our supervisor, in a bad-mouthing way. What do you know I'm doing when you and I have a falling out?
Same thing.
That's right, same thing. Because you know my nature. If you want to retain those who are present, be loyal to those who are absent. Because what do they know you're going to be like when other people are bad-mouthing them to you behind your back? It's far greater to be trusted and respected than it is to be liked. So you're taking the long view. Your integrity, which means you operate on the same principle toward the totality of your relationships, is intact. That builds the emotional bank account in powerful ways. Even though at the time when you badmouth somebody with someone else, it may seem to kind of cement your relationship. To use the construction expression, it's bad cement, it's bad mud. All it will take is a storm on that relationship and that internal flaw will surface. It doesn't build the relationship, it hurts. Far better to say when someone's badmouthing somebody else, I think you have a good point. Let's go and talk to that person. Let's go and make an effective presentation to that person to help that person. They know you would do the same thing to them if someone was badmouthing them to you. But a lot of people aren't ready for that confrontation. It's so much easier to sit and badmouth, to complain, to murmur and moan. It's easy. Seems to, you know, make you feel better. You get validation from someone, they massage your heart. Remember this, it's greater to be trusted, greater to be respected than to be liked. That's PC activity. Interestingly, it's also P activity. It produces golden eggs almost instantly. If it doesn't instantly, it will eventually. That's the true essence of happiness, is the willingness to subordinate what we want now for what we want eventually. So sometimes it takes a little self-denial and sacrifice of what we want right now, that golden egg right now, in order to make the deposit into the emotional bank account and build it up so that we can have what we want eventually. The preservation of the asset, the enhancement of the asset, the people that will continue to produce the golden eggs. Sixth, if you blow any of the above five, learn to say, I'm sorry, I apologize. And we all do blow them from time to time. But the one thing that people will not forget or forgive is a cover-up. Even presidents can be deposed through cover-ups. The anatomy of cover-up usually is pride and leads to defensiveness, self-protection, self-justification, accusation of other people, and the whole relationship deteriorates. You've often seen it even in marriages. from one of spontaneity and richness, softness, to one of accommodation, to one of toleration, into various forms of hostility that may break out in hot wars in a legal court or cold wars in the four walls of your own home, which ooze out into the emotional atmosphere, the ecology of the home, a powerful osmosis kind of teaching to the next generation, where they learn that the way to solve problems is to fight, to take each other on, or to flight, to withdraw, to give up, to capitulate. Dominant Dan, Dorothy, doormat may seem to have a harmonious marriage, but remember that unexpressed feelings never die. They're buried alive and come forth later in uglier ways. The emotional bank account's overdrawn. And with the key relationships of our lives, the emotional bank accounts will evaporate if we don't constantly make deposits into them. They require constant nurturance, constant feeding, constant tending to keep them rich and filled with joy and happiness and kindness and the spirit of forgiveness and humanity and softness and gentleness. The opposite of all of those six things, of course, are withdrawals. Now, I must say at this juncture that sometimes we can get too focused on the PC and neglect the golden eggs, too focused only on, say, education, and neglect the industry that produces the golden eggs, the money that supports the education. Some people run for 3-4 hours a day bragging about the 10 extra years of life it gives them, unaware they're spinning them running. We can get imbalanced in the other direction. Or sometimes you can get the wrong kind of PC, as is found, I believe, in many quick fix training programs in organizations. Doesn't work. You know, I remember a while back I was teaching and someone came up and we were kind of just musing, looking outside, and he said, "Frankly, Stephen, I don't enjoy these seminars very well." "Really? What's the problem?" He said, "Well, I get grilled at night on the phone by my wife. Unbelievably grilled. She wants to know everywhere I've been, everything that I'm doing, with whom. All right, what'd you do this morning? And what about your lunch? Who'd you have lunch with? And then the afternoon? And then the evening? What did you do then? What kind of entertainment?" You know, asking all these questions, almost asking, "Whom can I call to verify all this? Look at this beautiful scene out here. Look at how much these people are enjoying themselves." He said, "Of course, she knows all the right questions to ask because I met her when I was on one of these trips and married to someone else." And I asked, "You're kind of into quick fix, aren't you?" He said, "What do you mean?" "You'd like to have your wife's head rewired instantly, right?" "Well, I don't know about that, Stephen, but the thing is, I just feel like it's not a good attitude to have. I mean, it just makes my life kind of miserable." I said, "My friend, you can never talk yourself out of problems you behaved yourself into. If you have a 100,000 overdrawn emotional bank account, you have to make many deposits for a long period of time to get into the plus figures. There is no quick fix in relationships. There must be high integrity and consistency behind your values and your habits, that they're congruent with each other. Then eventually, if you make the six kinds of deposits I've been speaking about, a whole new level of confidence will come into the relationship. And the fruits of that are unbelievably marvelous. To maintain the PPC balance, the balance between the golden egg, the thing we want, and the health and welfare of the goose, production capability is a difficult judgment call. It's elusive. But I suggest it is the very essence of effectiveness. It balances short-term with long-term. It balances going for the grade and paying the price to get an education. It balances the desire to have that room clean and the building of the relationship so that the child is internally committed to do it, cheerfully, willingly, without external supervision. It balances getting cooperation between those warring departments and producing the fruits of that cooperation, with the cultivating of a culture or an atmosphere that causes the two departments to empathize with each other, to understand each other's concerns and problems, and to create new solutions that are better solutions than either department originally proposed. That is called synergy, the sixth habit, which we will go into later. That, in a sense, is the summum bonum of all else we're trying to do. If you can get that kind of thing, a high level of cooperation, a high level of teamwork, an extremely productive culture on a roll with real momentum based on correct principles over a long period of time, you know you've got the basic principles and habits of effectiveness interwoven in the total fabric of that situation.
Welcome to Tape 2 of The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. The 7 habits are interrelated, interdependent, and sequential. On this side, Stephen describes how the 7 habits can help us progress from a state of dependence to a state of interdependence.
Now, my friends, we're going to move into the second part. We have defined basic habits, and we have defined effectiveness. And those two definitions were very important before we approach the 7 habits. I'm going to give an overview of these 7 habits on what I call a maturity continuum. A maturity continuum basically ranges at the low end from dependency up at the upper end to interdependency. The middle position is called independency. Now let's define each of those terms for a moment. Dependency is the attitude of you. You take care of me. You come through for me. You didn't come through. I blame you for these results. The attitude of independency is I can do it. I will. Yes. No. I won't. I prefer. Self-reliance. It takes self-confidence to be self-reliant. The attitude or word symbol of interdependency is we. We can do it. We will do it. We'll cooperate. We'll accomplish this. Dependent people need others to get what they want. Independent people can get what they want through their own effort. Interdependent people require their own effort and the cooperation of others to get what they want. It doesn't take much thought, really, to realize how much more mature interdependency is than independency. Also, it doesn't take much thought to realize you cannot really be interdependent, that is, the we attitude, the team spirit, the cooperation spirit, until you are first independent. That's why independence is such a major achievement, so that people are not being victimized by other people. For instance, let's say I'm emotionally and financially dependent upon you. You're my supervisor, you're my boss, you're my father, you're my teacher at school, whatever the situation may be. My grade, my promotions, my salary, a function of your judgment. And also my sense of worth comes from you. If I'm very dependent that way, would I be a good cooperative team member? Would I give you feedback about some of the things we need to do to improve this operation, or feedback about your own blind spots? All a blind spot is a hidden weakness. We're all aware of our weaknesses, but blind spots are far more tender. We protect ourselves from those areas, and sometimes they're crippling to us in our effectiveness, and we need feedback. But dependent people will not give that feedback. They cannot risk that kind of vulnerability. They cannot risk possibly compromising their career path. So they won't do it. They'll badmouth and bad think instead. I'll tell you another reason they won't give feedback. They're too angry. They're too upset. And they know if they were to express themselves with that spirit, it would disrupt the relationship. They can't risk that. They're too dependent upon the other person. So they cannot be interdependent because they are not yet independent. If a person was financially independent, that doesn't mean they're financially wealthy at all. Some wealthy people are financially very dependent upon their wealth. And if the wealth is lost or devalued for some reason, they're wiped out. But a financially independent person is one who has so many skills and such capacity. There are many options that they could take for employment. They are capable of producing a livelihood for themselves and for their loved ones in many different ways. So they're not running scared of a boss's opinion. And they can be empathic and kind and also direct and forthright and courageous because they're independent. Emotionally, their sense of worth does not come from other people's opinions. It comes basically from within themselves, from intrinsic sources of personal security. Fundamentally, it comes from their integrity to their own value system. So they're more independent. I'll tell you one of the clearest ways to tell whether you and I are dependent is to study anger. Anger and fear, really. Both reveal dependency. Whatever makes me angry or I'm fearful of reveals my dependency. Oh, he makes me so mad, you cannot believe what I... Look how that person's weakness is controlling my behavior. Look how dependent I am. How many of us have a tendency to come back defensively when we're being unjustly dealt with or attacked? It's a natural tendency. How many of us do better when we're treated better? Most of us do. We're very dependent upon the external environment. What if we could carry inside of us enough inward security that we are a function of our values rather than of the conditions, physical or social, that we may encounter? What if we could carry our own weather with us? What if our life was almost totally a product of our value system? Think how independent we could become and how effective we could become, because one of the values we treasure is to be effective with other people, not just to be right and isolated and independent. We want to be interdependent because the very nature of life is interdependent. Think of what we learn in the field of ecology. I just recently read an article on what happens when the rainforests in the South American continent are depleted, the effect that has upon weather and upon vegetation and animal life and humankind elsewhere. Many people are speculating about this hole in the ozone layer, the thinning of it, the bad air, the bad water that can come when people violate ecological principles. Everything is related to everything else, like the domino effect. We are highly interdependent beings, but we can only achieve interdependence if we first become independent to a very high degree, emotionally, intellectually, financially, and physically. I would say physically is the least important. A person can be very handicapped and require other people to help him or her through life physically, but still be intellectually, emotionally, financially, extremely independent.
Stephen continues his discussion of the maturity continuum by explaining why habits 1, 2, and 3 are basically character habits that enable us to move from dependency to independency.
I've got to tell you a study I made for a bicentennial study. I made it in 1976 and studied the success literature in this country over a 200-year period from 1776. I became fascinated. It got me literally into hundreds, even thousands of books. And I could clearly see a fundamental shift taking place in this success literature. I'm talking about the success literature that's popular in the magazines and the books. For the first 150 years in this country, almost the entire thrust and theme of the success literature was character. Character. Characteristics of the person. Basic habits, such as industry, integrity, modesty, thoughtfulness, love, service, and so forth. Character, see? The last 50 years, the focus shifted to one that we might call the personality ethic to differentiate it from the character ethic. It's heavily imbued by technique, technologies, how to lubricate the processes of human interaction, influence people, mental technologies, PMA, positive mental attitude, and other ways of organizing our life, our responses, so as to be effective with other people, without perhaps fundamentally dealing with our own character. These basic habits, these seven basic habits, help us to move from dependency through independency up into interdependency. And the first three habits are basically character habits. Character habits. The next three habits are what you might call personality habits, the outward expression of this independent character. I'm not against the concept of the personality ethic. I'm in favor of it, as long as it is a natural, congruent outgrowth of character. But if, like an iceberg, the tip of it, being personality, is separated from, truncated from, the great mass of the iceberg underneath the water, what happens is people begin to develop a life pattern of habits that are manipulative and often deceptive. They work with hidden agendas, and they're heavy into techniques and quick fix ideas, ways of getting what they want now. And sometimes they're able to, and they can move from one field of endeavor to another. However, study any long-term relationship with those manipulators, those people that are taking withdrawals from the emotional bank account. Study any long-term relationship, and the natural principles being violated will expose the flaw in that personality approach. It'll expose it. They'll be found out. And then they often will pretend it and fake it for the public. But their private lives are often in shambles. And they know it. And their marriages and their family lives. It's a joke. They're not really independent. They're not interdependent. They're dependent. Or sometimes it's a counterfeit independency called counterdependency. They're in a state of rebellion. They're still being controlled by the thing that they need, only in a negative way. Like teenage kids sometimes may rebel against their parents, and the parents looking at their behavior may think, I have no influence with these kids. In fact, the parents are controlling those kids only in a negative way. They do the very opposite of what the parents want. It's called a counterdependency. It isn't true independency. To develop an independent character is a major achievement. Interdependence is the choice which independent people can make. Dependent people cannot choose to become interdependent. They don't have enough character strength inside themselves. They don't own themselves enough. They don't know who they are enough. They don't have a deep enough sense of self. They don't know what they stand for. They become almost like chameleons, that little animal that blends into whatever environment it's in. And the principle that runs their life is expediency, not integrity. And eventually, in long-term relationships, you'll see overdrawn emotional bank accounts. It's inevitable, particularly in times of stress, fatigue, times of storm. The shallowness of the root structure will be revealed. So I was very, very intrigued by that bicentennial study and persuaded me to try to focus on the study of those habits that are fundamentally character habits, habits 1, 2, and 3, and habits 4, 5, and 6 are the natural fruits of those character roots. They also become habits. They are the personality expressions of that character. They're congruent with it. All of us know from our experiences in school that you need to take some classes before you can take other classes. You need to study math before you can possibly understand algebra, and algebra before you can deal with calculus. We know that in farming we need to plant before we can harvest, with all of the intervening processes between. We know with our children that they learn to walk before they run, and they crawl before they walk. In nature, all things work in a sequence. And to me, one of the fundamental flaws with simplistic success formulas and human relations technologies is they do not respect that natural principle. It is futile to try to improve relationships without trying to improve ourselves. It is worthless and futile to try to develop new communication strategies and human relations techniques if fundamentally we're duplicitous and deceitful and lazy. Flaky people will be found out under stress and pressure, even though on the surface they might put on a very charming exterior. So I put a heavy emphasis on the sequencing of these habits. And by the way, these habits are the best research habits you'll find in all literature. And I'll tell you the best source for you to validate that. Examine your own lives. These habits are so self-evident that once you understand them, they're not arguable. You'll find as we go through these seven habits, they're the very essence of the natural laws of life. All right then, let's remember. Habits 1, 2, and 3 are habits of character that enable us to move from dependency to independency. A major achievement. Habits 4, 5, and 6 are habits of the outward expression of character in the relationship with other people. We could call that personality if you wish. That's the fruit. The fundamental habits are the roots.
Stephen next discusses habit 1, entitled Be Proactive, and explains why we must take individual responsibility for our own life and choices.
The first habit, the most fundamental habit of all, is the habit of being proactive. That basically means you take responsibility for yourself. You get out of blaming circumstances, conditions, or conditioning for your behavior. Look at the word responsibility. Ability to choose your response. Responsibility. I suggest effective people are proactive. That is, they take responsibility. Their behavior is a product of their own decisions based on values, rather than being a product of their conditions based on feelings. For instance, you're planning a picnic with your family. You're excited, you have all the preparations, You've decided where to go, and it becomes stormy, killing your plan. Proactive people carry weather within them. They realize what their purpose really was, and they creatively have a picnic elsewhere, even if it's in their own basement with some special games, and make the best of that situation. The opposite of being proactive is to be reactive. Reactive people would say, what's the use? We can't do anything. Oh, this is so upsetting after all of our preparations. We've made these arrangements. And the whole spirit of negativism will tend to pervade those people's minds and also the family. That's being reactive. Those who have studied psychology 101, what is it when we call these two little boxes that are connected together? Stimulus response. They're totally connected together. Put out meat, ring a bell, the dog salivates. Meat, bell, salivate. Meat, bell, salivate. Take away the meat, ring the bell, the dog salivates. That's called reactive. The stimulus created the response. There's three fundamental theories of determinism that are widely accepted in our society, or a combination of the three. Determinism is the stimulus response concept. That is, that our life has been determined by things outside of it, or perhaps by the deep internal scripting of earlier generations inside of it. First, it's called genetic determinism. That means your grandparents did it to you. That's why you have a short fuse. And besides that, you're Irish. And that's the nature of Irish people. Yeah, I have a short fuse. Everyone in my family seems to go through the generations. The second is called psychic determinism. That means your parents did it to you. That's why you're a night owl. You're not good in the morning, right? Neither were your parents. Or you're a compulsive punctual. You're just literally guilt-tripped right out of your gourd if you're late. Because you can remember deep inside the emotional scripting when you were very vulnerable and tender and dependent. The punishment that came, the rejection, the comparison with somebody else when you were late to school or to some appointment or something of this nature. That's called psychic determinism. The third is called environmental determinism. That means that it is your boss that's doing it to you. It's your spouse. It's that bratty teenager. That's what's messing up your home life. Or it's the economics of your life. That's what's doing it to you. That's why you're so unhappy and miserable. Or because of national policies, or the absence of certain programs, or whatever. The language of reactive people, of people who are determined by their environment, or by their conditions, or by their conditioning, or their genetic makeup, is, I can't do it. That's my nature. Can't. Don't have time. I have to. I have to. I must. See, the whole spirit of that language is the transfer responsibility. I am not responsible, able to choose my response. The spirit is, I am not responsible. Psychologically, isn't that easier to say than I'm a flake and irresponsible? The problem is, this is a self-fulfilling prophecy. People who believe they are determined will produce the evidence to support the belief. And they increasingly feel victimized and out of control. They're not in charge of their life or their destiny at all. They're always in a blaming mode to things outside. They might even blame themselves. Or they might even attribute it to the stars. Yeah, I'm Capricorn. That's why I'm so hesitant to make a decision this week, because it says in my astrological stargazing directive that I should not make any big decisions in this month or this week. I'll wait for next month. It says I'll have good judgment there. If I believe it, I'll probably act on the basis of it and produce the evidence to support the belief. You know what the database is for determinism? Primarily, it's the study of animals and sick people. Seriously, how do you like that as a database to talk about you? What kind of a vision do you have of your human capacity? Can you choose your response to whatever happens to you? Absolutely you can. Nothing can hurt you without your consent. Eleanor Roosevelt once put it, no one can make you feel inferior without your permission. Gandhi put it, they cannot take away our self-respect if we do not give it to them. If you could emotionally understand this idea, you'd find it's the most liberating idea you can imagine. One time in Sacramento, I was talking on this to a large group of people, and a lady stood up and literally became so excited, she started talking to people, then grew embarrassed, sat back down, but talked privately. I could hardly wait for the break to find out what had happened. I went to her, and she said, you cannot believe what's happened to me. She says, I am the full-time nurse to the most miserable and grateful man you can possibly imagine. And for you to have the gall, the presumptiveness, to stand up there and to suggest, I am responsible? That I chose to be miserable? There's no way I could buy into that. But the more I thought about it, the more I swallowed that bitter pill, and I came to realize, now wait a minute. If I have the power to choose, if between stimulus and response there is a small gap of freedom to choose my response to the stimulus, I could choose not to be miserable. I could choose not to be any more controlled by this guy that I'm the full-time nurse to, who's made my life so miserable, who never even acknowledges me, let alone express appreciation. No longer am I going to, using my language now, empower his weaknesses to control me, to mess my life up. And she said, at that moment, I stood up. I was let out of San Quentin. I was let out of prison. I wanted to proclaim my liberty. I wanted to proclaim my freedom. Thrilling, honestly. I've never known a more inspiring, lofty, exalting notion in my life than the inward realization, the personal vision. That's what the habit, being proactive, is. It's the habit of personal vision. Never known anything with more personal vision and excitement in it than the realization I am able to choose my own response to whatever happens to me. And the further advanced realization that in choosing that response, you can powerfully affect what happens to you. As I mentioned earlier, your head creates your world. And this is some of the psychology as to exactly how it creates your world. You change one variable in any chemical formula and you change the results of that formula. You change yourself in your marriage. Don't try to change the other. Don't confess your spouse's sins one more time. Work only on your own. You change yourself inside a family life. Be a source of giving unconditional love and support and affirmation and courageous but kind discipline. Be a source of working only upon things you have direct control over, and you watch what begins to happen over time as you make constant deposits into the emotional bank account in all the relationships of that home. I might mention a couple of practices that I have found helpful in my life. The principle is what I'm trying to teach, however, not these practices. The principle is make deposits with your relationships. The practice is I sit in the car before I go into the house and go through a little kind of affirmation process. I am fatigued. My family may be in there confessing each other's sins. And I sit there and say, I am now going to do the most important work of my day. It's in the four walls of my own home. It's not only the most important, it's the most joyful, the most fulfilling. As a husband and as a father, I'm going to bless my wife and my children by my touch and by my voice. Then go in, go to each one, look them square in the eye, embrace them. Express your love, express your interest about their day. Just do that. 5 minutes can change the ecology of your home if it's congruent with the way you live in the other 55 minutes of every hour. Another practice with my wife is we go on a Honda 90 trail cycle every day. If I'm on a trip, we do it on a phone. If it's inclement weather, we do it in a car. No one can get to us, no kids, no meetings, and just learn to express feelings. If you want to stay in love, learn to express feelings, not opinions. Opinions are fun, but they're safe. Always stay vulnerable. You can afford to stay vulnerable if down deep you're invulnerable. If you're emotionally independent, and the first three habits will help us develop that internal personal security.
On this side, Stephen continues his discussion of habit one, be proactive, by showing how we can choose our own response to a given situation, making us more a product of our values and decisions rather than our moods and conditions.
One of my favorite books on this subject is called Man's Search for Meaning, written by an Austrian psychiatrist by the name of Viktor Frankl, F-R-A-N-K-L. In it, he describes his autobiographical experiences in the death camps of Nazi Germany during World War II, where he was imprisoned as a Jewish political prisoner. It's hard to describe the depth of pain, torture, indignity that he experienced. To do so would be almost repugnant to our own sense of decency and virtue. We would not even want to talk about it. I read many of his other books to get a deeper understanding of how he developed his theories of logotherapy. Logo means meaning. The concept is that if you have a why, you can live with any what, any how. As long as there's a purpose, a meaning, some value to be served or actualized. And that the highest value is how you deal with suffering, with difficult circumstances. That's where your greatest influence with others is. How many of you have ever experienced someone with a wasting disease go through a very, very prolonged, painful, tragic disease and death, maintaining a magnificent attitude? How many have ever experienced or seen that? Well, if you have, you'll know what I'm speaking about. Frankl, one day, put under white light, stripped naked, while they began to perform these ignoble sterilization experiments upon his body, discovered what he called the last ultimate freedom. He had a personal vision of his proactive nature. I'm using my words, not his, but he called it The last ultimate freedom could not be taken from me. They could hurt my body, but they could not hurt me, who lives in this body. And through a series of disciplines, mental, emotional, moral, principally using memory and imagination, he exercised this small embryonic freedom until it grew larger and larger, until he had more freedom than his captors. They had more liberty than he. Liberty is a condition of the environment. Freedom is a condition of the person. Liberty means you have many options to choose among in your environment. Freedom means you have the internal power to exercise those options. That's what it means to be proactive. That's what it means to be in charge of your life, to emotionally accept this. But this is very hard doctrine, particularly if you've had years and years of explanation as to why you're unhappy and miserable in the name of somebody else or something else. You have to swallow a bitter pill, but once you swallow it, it is completely liberating, exciting, at a level you've never tasted before. I was speaking one time on proactivity, and in the middle of the presentation, someone visited with me and said, "I like what you're saying, Stephen, but it seems that every situation is so different, and I'm really worried about our marriage because my wife and I, we just don't have the same feelings toward each other that we once had, and I guess love just isn't there anymore." And I said, "Well, then, what is your plan?" He said, "I don't know, that's the concern, because we have these three kids and we're really concerned about it. What do you think?" I said, "Love her." "Well, I know, but the feeling isn't there." "Well, then love her." "You don't understand, the feeling of love just isn't there." "Love her." Love is a verb, not a feeling. You study all the great literature, you'll find that love the feeling is the fruit of love the verb. Love is something you do, the sacrifices you make, the giving of self. Just like a mother bringing a newborn into the world. The love that she has for this child because of what she went through to produce it. That's hard doctrine, however. And unless people develop a tremendous reservoir of emotional capacity and independence, they will not have the power to love unconditionally. Unconditional love is the fruit of other roots. I suggest the first part of that root is the acceptance of responsibility for my own response, and to stop transferring responsibility outside myself. In a sense, to use the computer metaphor, habit one, the habit of being proactive. Be proactive. That habit is the habit of personal vision. It's the awareness that you are indeed in control. That's habit one. What's habit two? If you're the programmer, to use this computer analogy, what do you think habit two is? Write the program. What's habit three? Live it. Live the program. Those are the first three habits. Habit one, you're the programmer. Be proactive. Habit two, write the program. You want to be more proactive? Write a program. Write your own script. Habit three, live it. We call habit two, begin with the end in mind. That means you get a mental image in your mind. It's your program of where you want to end up. And that end guides you day by day, just like a construction person going to the construction shed every morning, studying the blueprint, the end, in mind, and then letting that blueprint guide every decision in the construction process. There are always two creations. The physical creation follows the mental creation. Take the building or the house that you're in now. It was created in every detail before the earth was touched. Right or wrong? If wrong, you've got some pretty expensive change orders in that structure that might have significantly increased the cost of it, even doubled the cost of it. The carpenter's rule holds true. Measure twice, cut once. So what's habit two? Simply, begin with the end in mind. Write the program. Decide what your own value system is. Write your own philosophy, your own mission statement, your own creed, your belief system. And get it written into your mind and into your heart through the use of imagination and your emotion. Don't tie yourself to your history. Tie yourself to your potential. Your history is part of your memory. Your potential is part of your imagination. That's a unique human capacity. Animals do not possess any of. You can project your consciousness anywhere you wish into the future. Time, place, has no relevance at all with the power of your imagination. And if you learn to imagine vividly enough and to also draw heavily upon the inner sense or conscience of what is right or wrong, you will come to detect the most fundamental principles that pertain to your life. and you can distill them in the form of a mission statement or a value system or a purpose statement, whatever you wish to call it. This is the essence of Habit 2. You might call Habit 2 the leadership habit, the habit of personal leadership or organizational leadership. Habit 3 would then be called the management habit, the personal management habit, or the organizational management habit. Now, what is the difference between leadership and management? Leadership deals with direction. Management deals with speed, coordination, logistics, in going in that direction. Have you ever climbed a ladder of success and got to the top rung and realized it was leaning against the wrong wall? See, people that are heavily scripted by their own upbringing or by their circumstances, and they have no personal vision of their proactive capability, all they do is live by other people's agendas, scripts, roles. And those people, or those experiences by those people, outside themselves provide the leadership of their life. They're not in charge of their own life. Then they may manage themselves around that leadership. It's the wrong wall. It's not where they wanted to be at all. Have you ever neglected your health or your family in the name of work? Is it really worth it in the long run? There may be times where you need to make short-term sacrifices in order to model and in order to contribute, but as a constant diet, you don't want that. What is it all about? If you want a clear understanding of the difference between management and leadership, imagine the scene. Someone going through the jungle with a machete, cutting the undergrowth, clearing it up. They're the producers down there. See, the workers. Here all the managers are, back here, sharpening the machetes for them, putting on muscle development classes for machete wielders, setting up working schedules for machete wielders, handling jurisdictional disputes between machete wielders. The leader climbs the tallest tree in the jungle, surveys the entire scene, studies the larger picture, and screams out, "Wrong jungle!" And all the managers shout back, "Shut up, we're making progress!" I remember talking on this one time up in Seattle at one of our year-long executive development programs. And I talked on the second time, on the 12th time, the 12th month, the president of an oil company came up to me and said, "Stephen, when you pointed out the difference between leadership and management on the second month, I looked at myself as the president of this company and realized I've never done Habit 2, really. I've never been into leadership. I'm deep into management. I am buried by the details of day-to-day logistical management, or as one person puts it, the thick of thin things. So I decided to withdraw from management, get other people to do that, which is a necessary function, and get deep into leadership. It was so hard. I went through such withdrawal pains because I was taking the longer view, not dealing with a lot of the pressing, urgent matters that were right in front of me. I didn't receive the satisfaction of those small accomplishments while I dealt with the direction issues, the culture building issues, the deep analysis of problems, the seizing of new opportunity issues. Others also went through withdrawal pains because they wanted my accessibility as I had been before. They wanted me to be available to them, to respond and to solve them on a day-to-day basis. They wanted me into management, but I persisted. I was absolutely convinced I needed to provide leadership. And I did. Today, this was about 11 months after the experience, the learning experience, he said, "Our whole business is different. We're more in alignment with our environment. We have doubled our sales and quadrupled our profits. I'm into leadership." I'm convinced that too often, parents are in the paradigm of management, not leadership. They're thinking of control, of things, and of efficiency. That's habit three. Habit two deals with purpose, values, philosophy, direction. What is it we're really about? And also with causing an internal feeling, a climate, a character, a culture, so that the feeling is good, harmonious, committed. The solution, I'm convinced, to most marriage and family problems is more leadership, less management. We manage things, we lead people. However, management also is important. After we have decided what the right things are to do, we want to do them right. We must focus on efficiency. We must focus on the bottom line. But Habit 2 focuses on leadership, on the top line. What is it we're fundamentally about? Simply put, how do you create a culture
are proactive people. Write a corporate mission statement. Write a department mission statement. Write a work group mission statement. Write a family mission statement, or one for your marriage. Then set up the reward system and the information system to constantly reinforce exactly what you want as expressed in the mission statement. And if you do that over time, consistently, and if your own style is congruent with it, you will find yourself creating a highly creative, win-win, synergistic culture.
Stephen continues his discussion of Habit 2, entitled Begin with the End in Mind, by explaining how we can create powerful mission statements in our personal, family, and organizational lives.
Let me tell a recent experience I had in a hotel. I was totally amazed at the level of service at that hotel. It wasn't a cosmetic thing. It was evident at all levels, spontaneously, without supervision. For instance, I arrived late that night, checked in, asked if the room service was available. They said no, but the person said to me, "But Mr. Covey, if you're interested, I could go back and get a soup or salad or whatever you like, whatever we have in the kitchen, and bring it to you." I was totally amazed at that attitude. And he found out why I was there. I was training 175 shopping center managers. "Would you like to see the room? Do you have everything that you need? What could I do? We're here to serve you." There was no supervisor there checking up. There was another person that could have handled the desk when he wasn't there. I was doing some teaching the next day and didn't have all the colored markers I wanted. So I ran out in the hall during a brief break, found some bellboy running to another convention altogether different, stopped him and said, "I've got a problem. I'm in here teaching. I only have a short break and I need some more colored pens, some markers." He just whipped around like coming to an attention, looked at my name tag and said, "Mr. Covey, I will solve your problem." I mean, he didn't say, "Well, go and check with these people," or, "I don't know anything about it. I don't know where you'd go," and absolve himself of responsibility. And I thought, my, how do you get a culture where people deeply buy into its mission of customer service? How do you do that? I was in a side lobby standing there, and someone came up from the hotel. I was looking at some of the art objects, saw my name tag, and said, "Mr. Covey, would you like to see a book that describes the art objects in this hotel?" Look how anticipatory. What service-orientedness. Someone was cleaning windows high in a lobby on a ladder. Saw a woman having a little difficulty in the garden with a walker. She hadn't fallen. There were other people around. He climbs down that ladder, goes outside, helps that woman into the lobby, and sees that she's properly taken care of, and climbs back up and continues his washing. I interviewed housekeepers, waitresses, and found that this attitude had impregnated everyone's minds. How did it get into people's minds, hearts, and attitudes? Their very habits, see? I went in a side room, went through the back door into the kitchen. I saw the motto, uncompromising personalized service. I went to the manager and said, "My business is helping organizations develop a powerful team character, a team culture, and I am amazed at what you have here." He said, "You want to know the real key?" He pulls out the mission statement for the hotel chain. I said, "That's a very impressive statement, but I know many companies that have impressive mission statements." He said, "You want to see the one for this hotel?" "You mean you developed one inside this hotel?" "Yeah." "Different?" "Yeah." "Pertains to our situation, this environment, our clientele, a lot of the same things." "Who developed that?" He said, "Everybody." "Really, everybody?" "Housekeepers?" "Yes." "Waitresses?" "Yes." "Everybody. Everyone got involved." I said, "What about the people last night that greeted me at the front desk? Do you want to see their mission statement?" He pulled out a mission statement that they themselves had written that was interwoven, interlocked with all the other mission statements. And everyone was involved. Then that mission statement is used as the criteria or the frame of reference by which all of the decisions are made. How we relate to the customer, how we relate to each other. So that affects the style of the managers and the leaders. That affects what is rewarded in the compensation system. It affects the kind of people you recruit, attract, how you train and develop them. Every aspect of that organization essentially was a function of the hub of the wheel, the center. That is what Habit 2 is. It's the determination of developing a center, to get centered around a set of principles, values, and purposes that transcend the day-to-day. That is Habit 2. Recently, our family reworked our mission statement as a family to reflect kind of the situation as it is now and to improve it, to strengthen it. And it was a meaningful experience. In fact, we're still in the process. I'm convinced that you should not do it rapidly. I encourage businesses to at least take 6 months to a year, maybe 2 years, to write a mission statement, because the key is to have it written in people's hearts and minds, and unless they're significantly involved, it will not take place. The key to commitment is involvement. No involvement, no commitment. Write it down, mark it, asterisk it, circle it. It is an absolute correct principle. Now, you don't have to get involvement up front. Sometimes you hire new people. How do you involve them? Deep education. Training them. What does it mean to serve the customer this way? Why is it we have this? Train them before you bring them on board so that they buy into the mission statement before they come on board. It's like the United States Constitution. It's fundamentally changeless. You can change it. We've had 26 amendments, 10 of which were in the original Bill of Rights, only 16 really, but over a 200-year period. And still, it is the standard by which all laws are evaluated. It is the thing that the president agrees to defend and support when he takes the oath of allegiance. It is the criteria by which people are admitted into citizenship in this country. It is the foundation and the center that enables us to ride through major traumas to its national life, like Vietnam or Watergate or the Civil War or whatever. I suggest Habit 2 is the development of the Constitution, the mission statement, the value system. You have to be proactive to do it. You have to believe that you're the programmer before you would really undertake to write the program. Many people have kind of had it with goals because they have set them, never achieved them, made promises and broke them. Why? Because they're not proactive. They're a function of their moods. They're a function of their spleen. They're a function of circumstances. Therefore, they'll give up on those things and they lose control. Then they are truly victimized. They're not in control. There's two basic ways to get into control rapidly of your life. One, set a goal and work to achieve it because you're in control of that. Two, make a promise and work to keep it. Immediately you get in control of your life and immediately you get new self-confidence from that self-control. Self-confidence is inward security. A lot of different words are used. Self-esteem, self-respect, self-image, self-concept. I personally prefer the word self-confidence. It basically means that your source of security comes from within yourself. You're confident in your integrity to your own value system. Most people's sense of security comes from other people. That's why they're so hung up on being compared and accusations of unfairness and why they develop the scarcity mentality. But if people will cultivate the intrinsic sources, such as continued PC on self, getting close to nature, building a family relationship where you have unconditional love supplies, living with integrity toward your own value system, sharpening the saw regularly, anonymous service where you desire no recognition, those kinds of sources feed an internal source. It's not based on people's opinions or on comparisons. I want you to think on this for a moment and get yourself into the frame of mind of attending a funeral of a dear one. In your mind's eye, see yourself driving to that funeral, arriving, it's being held at a church, getting yourself situated in a back seat, and you come to a growing awareness that it is your funeral, that it is you in that casket 3 years from now. There are four speakers. The place is packed. And there's a great feeling of love, appreciation, and resonating value of this person, your life. The four speakers are these. One from your family, not just your nuclear family, but aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents have come from all around the country to attend. One from your friends that give a sense of what you were as a person, as a friend. One from your work, your profession, or outside activity, and one from your church or some community organization where you've been involved in giving service. Now think, what would you like to have said 3 years from now about you? As a member of an intergenerational extended family, as a friend, as a working associate, or a public servant, what would you like to have said about your character, about your contributions, and about your achievements? Think carefully on those roles and write the eulogies. Think for a moment. Family. What kind of a father, mother, husband, wife, brother, sister, son, daughter? What kind of character, contributions? Think. Write the eulogy. What kind of a friend? What kind of a working associate? What kind of a manager, executive? What kind of a public servant, church servant? Did you make a difference in people's lives? Would you want to? Write the eulogy. You're in control. Habit one is the habit of personal vision. Habit one, you're the programmer. Habit two, write the program. You're writing it. You're writing not only a mission statement, but you're breaking it down into the specific roles and the goals which attend those roles that you want to have accomplished in each of those roles. In that way, you have not only prioritized your life, you have balanced it. You've got harmony. You make sure that all the major roles of your life you attend to on a weekly basis, so you don't get totally absorbed, taken over by some one dominant role like a work role, and end up taking major withdrawals from the emotional bank account with the nearest people of your life, and thereby climb this great ladder of success, only to realize it is indeed leaning against the wrong wall.
Welcome to Tape 3 of the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Highly effective people do not really manage time, they manage self. Instead of reacting to the urgent and being caught up in the thick of thin things, effective people plan and execute according to their deepest priorities, as Stephen explains in Habit 3, entitled Put First Things First.
Habit 3 is the time management habit of putting first things first. Habit 3 is taking Habit 2 and making it happen. It's organizing and executing around your priorities. Habit 2 is those priorities. Habit 3 is doing it. Habit 3 is the discipline. Habit 3 is the temporal or the physical creation. Habit 2 is the mental creation or the spiritual creation. All things are created twice. Therefore, I suggest that you immediately begin a process that takes time to develop and write on paper and into your mind and heart your personal mission statement, your value system, and do it with your spouse for your marriage, and do it with your entire family for your family, and do it with your work group and your department and your division and the company, as much as you can possibly do as far as your influence goes. That's habit two. Then organize everything else around it and carry it out, even if it means you say no to other things that people think are popular with them. Because what you're really doing is saying yes to what is most important. Look at a diagram we could call a time management matrix that is made up of four different quadrants. You'll notice that quadrant one is made up of things that are important and also urgent. Now let's define these terms. Important means it attaches to habit two. Your mission, your roles and goals. That's what's important. It's habit two. You've decided what's important. You've decided the wall to lean your ladder against. You've decided the direction. That's important. Now what's urgent? Urgent is that which is pressing upon you, that which gives a sense of urgency. You must act upon it, like a ringing phone. That phone that's ringing may just be a total waste of your time. It's not attached to your mission, your roles, or goals at all. But it wants to be answered. And you could get easily sidetracked and go into management of the wrong things in the right way. Quadrant one is important and also urgent. We usually call those problems, crises. And they need to be attended to, or you don't survive. Or if you've got an important meeting come up, that would be quadrant one. Because if you don't attend that meeting, you're going to have a major problem. What's quadrant two? It's important, but not urgent. That means it attaches to your mission, your roles and goals, but there isn't a sense of now about it. What's quadrant three? It's urgent, but not important. It's pressing, it's proximate, it's in front of you, it's that ringing phone, it's that unanswered mail. It's all of those other distracting things that are important to other people, maybe. But they don't really attach to your overall mission or the organization's overall mission. What's quadrant four? It's a combination of being not urgent and not important. A lot of time wasting, pleasant things, extensive Monday morning quarterbacking, extensive television, unnecessary meetings, unprepared meetings, interruptions that can just consume the entire day, where you're very busy all day long and at the end of the day feel like I accomplished nothing. Now what I'd like to ask you to do, if you would, is to think of one activity in your life, one activity that if you did superbly well and consistently, that you absolutely are convinced it would produce marvelous results, the kinds of results you desire. Think of one activity. Think of one in your personal life, and then think of one in your work life, your public life, okay? Now just think for a moment. For instance, someone might say, if I were to spend deeper one-on-one time with my key associates at work, and with my loved ones at home. I'm convinced that those kinds of deposits would make a big difference on the kinds of results I want. All right. Now, what quadrant is the thing you wrote in? There's only one quadrant. It's two. It's two. Notice the question. One activity, you know, if you did it superbly well and consistently, that it would have marvelous results. Already you've said it's important, and you're also saying it's not urgent, or you'd be doing it. See, you do it superbly well and consistently. It's in quadrant two. Where is PC, my friends? Where's PC? It's two. Where's prevention? Two. Where are problems and crises? One. Where's production? P. One. PC? Two. Where's opportunities? Two. You will find as we go through these seven habits, every one of them is in quadrant two. Quadrant two is the entire key to management. You're working on the high leverage activities. Pareto, the great Italian philosopher in the field of efficiency, came up with what's called the 80-20 rule. 80% of the results flow from 20% of the activities. Those are all quadrant two activities. All of them. What do you think happens to quadrant one if you neglect quadrant two? If you neglect prevention, what's going to happen to problems? It's going to grow and grow until there's almost no other quadrants. It may consume your life. That's called management by crisis. And management by crisis just beats you up, burns you out, fatigues you, gets very, very large. What's going to happen to quadrant one if you attend to quadrant two? Get smaller and smaller. You'll still have some of it. Things you hadn't anticipated at all. Constant changes in our environment will create some of that. But it'll be manageable. It'll be workable. But you'll always have the sense that you're working on prevention and seizing new opportunities. Now, where are you going to get the time and attention to get into quadrant two? You can't get it from quadrant one. If you take it from there, you'll die. You're fighting off the alligators with your shovel. Where are you going to get the time and the attention to start digging the canal to drain the swamp so the alligators will go? That has to come from three and four. Quadrant four is totally worthless quadrant. Can you name one thing of any value or worth in quadrant four? Leisure. Is leisure important? Yes, then it's quadrant two. There's nothing of worth or value in quadrant four. Quadrant three also is essentially without value except on the part of other people. So basically you get your time for quadrant two from three and four. The whole time you're knocking those alligators out, the moment there you have a few seconds of break, you start throwing one shovel of dirt into another direction so you can get that canal built. Just keep doing it. Just keep stealing a little from quadrant three and quadrant four. Learn to say no pleasantly, smilingly, happily, but say no. Because in saying no to quadrants three and four, you're saying yes to quadrant two. And when you say yes to quadrant two, you make quadrant one increasingly small. And you're working on things that will matter most, not on things which matter least. Things which matter most, Goethe wrote, must never be at the mercy of things which matter least. However, the problem is, it takes certain capacities to work on quadrant two. What's the fundamental capacity? We've already talked about it. What is it?
Proactive.
You have to be proactive. Why? Quadrant one acts on you. Quadrant two must be acted upon. We are made in our essential humanity to act and not be acted upon. That's quadrant two. All deep relationship building, quadrant two. Planning and organizing, quadrant two. Personal preparation, quadrant two. Exercise, quadrant two. Reading, broad, deep reading, continual education, quadrant two. Quadrant two is the key. Most time management programs will teach you a checklist approach toward day-to-day planning, and you'll be essentially doing not much more than reorganizing today's crises. You have to have a longer view, at least a week, and that on the basis of even a huge view of a month, a quarter, semi-annual, annual, long-term, the 3 years, let's say, before you attend your own funeral. So the key is to think through habit two, your mission, what you are about. Habit three, to organize your life around those priorities and those values and to live by them. Again, let me summarize two and three together. Habit two is your mission with your roles and goals. Habit three is your scheduling around those roles and goals and mission and disciplining yourself to execute accordingly. Now, your time tool is your servant, not your master. People are always more important than things. So many times you will just simply subordinate your tool, your schedule, to a higher need. You don't think of people in efficiency terms. I had a son who was into that for a period of time. heavy efficiency on everything, and he had for his checklist that day to pick up some books, to wash his car, to drop Margaret, to get his schedule organized, and so forth. Problem is, they were all things except for Margaret. But they'd been going for a long period of time, and he'd finally come to the conclusion it's not going to work out. So, congruent with his efficiency model, called up on the phone, scheduled about 10 minutes for the visit, and dropped her, which was very traumatic and upsetting to her and involved a great deal more, but he was into efficiency. You don't think efficiency with people. You think efficiency with things. You manage things and lead people. So sometimes you have to bag your schedule for higher values. But if you've got habit two deep inside your heart and mind, you've got those higher values driving you. So if other things come up that seemingly upset the schedule, so what? The schedule is not important. What's important is your value system and your integrity toward it. So you'll immediately adapt. You're flexible. You're not hung up and guilt-tripped by changing a schedule or by not meeting some schedule. I've seen many parents, particularly mothers with small children, have a lot of hopes and desires to accomplish so many things, but all they did is meet needs of little children. And they've often been frustrated. Why? Frustration is a function of our expectations, our schedules, our expected pattern, not of our realizations. But if people are deep into mission and values, they can subordinate that schedule to the value and to the mission. And if that mother has a lot of little children around her, preschoolers, she can totally feel comfortable in accomplishing nothing but meeting needs and giving love and providing.
Stephen next reviews habits 1, 2, and 3 and outlines specific personal benefits that are attainable as one cultivates the first three habits.
My friends, let us review now the first three habits so that we feel a good and deep understanding about these habits. First is the habit of personal vision we call be proactive. Second is the habit of personal leadership we call begin with the end in mind. Third is the habit of personal management we call put first things first. I suggest there are four unique human endowments that animals do not possess necessary to fulfill those three habits. Habit one requires self-awareness, the awareness that you are not a script, that you can think about your scripts, about your programs, and begin the process of self-programming. Habit two requires the unique human endowments of imagination and conscience, where you can detect and invent meaning in any given set of circumstance. You can write your own mission statement, your own roles and goals. Habit three, the habit of personal management, is the second creation. It is the physical creation. It is the execution and requires the human endowment of willpower. Exercise independent will when you don't want to do it. Because you're not a function of what you want to do, you're a function of your values. That is the very nucleus of character. To do what you know you should do when you don't want to do it. Because you know eventually what it will produce. And above all, you're maintaining your integrity. Now, I want to show what happens when people cultivate those three habits. It produces an internal source of personal security. It produces a sense that I am in charge of my own life. A sense of self-reliance, of independence. And you don't get your sense of worth from being compared with other people. You see, most people have derived their sense of value and worth from such comparisons. In the academic world, the normal distribution curve. In the social world, if you belong because you conform to certain norms and expectations. In the athletic world, you're number one. Or you're not, you're number two. Most of people's experiences have given them a sense their worth is based on other people's opinions. It comes from an external or an extrinsic source. If love is given unconditionally in the first few years of children's lives, it gives them an inner sense of security that will last them the rest of their life. If it is given very conditionally, they begin to define themselves in relation to other people with whom they've been compared. Now, if they want to exercise their proactive capacities and write new scripts, it's as if they're giving themselves a new childhood. Otherwise, those scripts will direct them, guide them, and haunt them for the rest of their life. The child is father to the man. psychic determinism teaches. It is a lie, but for people who believe it, it's true. When you move onto a totally different path, a different road, as Robert Frost wrote in his poem, The Road Less Traveled, two paths diverge in the woods. I took the path less traveled. That made all of the difference. I'm talking about a totally different path. It's habits 1, 2, and 3. It's building your security on your integrity to your value system. That's what it is. That's character. Now what happens? Do you want to see the immediate fruit? You don't compare yourself with others. It produces what I call the abundance mentality. But if people have been deeply scripted into comparison for their sense of personal worth, they develop a scarcity mentality. There's only so much, only so many people can be A students. Only one person can be number one. Then they immediately begin to compare themselves with other people. Those individuals have a hard time being happy for the successes of others, particularly if those others are right around them, even members of their own family. They may experience a marvelous success, you know, and they might say to those, oh, I'm so happy for you, that's wonderful, but inwardly they're eating their heart out. Secretly, they even harbor hopes that people can experience misfortunes. Those are the fruits of a scarcity mentality. Can you see why it would be so hard to practice the relationship habits of 4, 5, and 6 with a scarcity mentality? Habit 4 itself, think win-win, means you're always looking for mutual benefit, for things that benefit all the people involved, including yourself. You're not into zero-sum thinking. You're not into competition. You can think cooperatively. You can think team. You can think we. And when push comes to shove, you think we the most, not the least. You don't immediately revert to that scripting unless habits 1, 2, or 3 are not deeply ground inside the character. Then, out of a scarcity mentality, you might learn the personality techniques of win-win. But when push comes to shove, when the storms descend, what you really are will surface, and you'll be inwardly torn, ambiguous, and duplicitous. And that eats at people, drains their energies, it produces psychosomatic illnesses. There are so many fruits of being inwardly conflicted. Trying to become all things to all people, you end up becoming nothing to everybody, including yourself. In one of those books I read in the Literature Review, Eric Fromm writes a paragraph at the end of The Sane Society, which capitalizes what happens when people get their sense of worth from other people. He put it this way, "Today we come across an individual who behaves like an automaton, who doesn't know or understand himself. And the only person that he knows is the person that he is supposed to be, whose meaningless chatter has replaced communicative speech, whose sense of dull despair has taken the place of genuine pain, and whose synthetic smile has replaced genuine laughter. Two statements may be said concerning this individual. One is that he suffers from the defects of spontaneity and individuality, which may seem to be incurable. At the same time, it may be said of him, he does not differ essentially from the millions of the rest of us who walk upon this earth." In other words, he's become alienated from himself and victimized, driven by the agendas, the schedules, the scripting, the programming of other people, other generations, or whatever. In fact, Martin Buber, in his brilliant book, I and Thou, traces the secularization of the culture similarly. I and Thou stands for I and Thou, God and His children. Thou, see, reverence. The next stage is I for myself. Thou for you, human beings, it for God. The next stage, I for myself, and it for you, where you become a manipulatable asset or resource to serve my purposes. And the last stage is it and it, the total alienation of self. And when the culture gets mature and ripened in an alienation from the value of human life and the respect for the dignity of the individuals that are there, including employees and customers, as well as loved ones, children, parents, and so forth, then a whole different paradigm pervades the culture that tends to become very alienating and dehumanizing, mechanistic, producing great misery and unhappiness. And then all there's left are pleasures, short-term gratifications. And the higher purposes that a person has thought about their own life, are not being served.
On this side, Stephen explains how habits 4, 5, and 6 are outward expressions of character and lead to interdependence, mutual benefit, and public victories.
I'm going to go through all three of the later habits, 4, 5, and 6. Think win-win is the attitude of seeking mutual benefit. How do you do that? You have to communicate. So habit 5 we call seek first to understand, then to be understood. That's the habit of communication. Habit 6 is the ultimate fruit. It's called synergize. Produce new solutions to the differences between us better than the ones I proposed or you proposed initially. It's the opposite of compromise. It's synergistic. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. Now let me go through this again and play a role to help teach habits 4, 5, and 6. Let's say that I'm communicating with a key person in my life. It may be my boss. It may be a key subordinate in a work setting. It may be my spouse or a child in a home setting. It may be a neighbor. We're talking about an issue that is important to us, even jugular, and we are approaching it differently. We see it differently. Watch the three habits, 4, 5, and 6. First, think win-win. Say to the person something like this. Why don't we agree to communicate until we can find a solution we both feel good about? Would you be willing to do that? In almost all cases, people will say yes to you. If they say no, it bespeaks the emotional bank account. Go back to making deposits. Go back to habits 1, 2, and 3, the character strength to make those deposits. But in almost all cases, people will say yes. Now watch habit 5. Let me listen to you first. Most people do the very opposite. They want to first be understood. And when both parties want to be understood simultaneously, that's called the collective monologue, the dialogue of the deaf. They're not really listening. They're either speaking or preparing their speech. So the fifth habit is communicate. First by listening, then expressing. Now what's habit 6? That's where you're very creative. And you think through new and better ways, new and better solutions. For instance, let's say that I want to go on a vacation out into the lake country, and you want to go on a vacation closer to your ailing mother. That's important to you. The other is important to me. I've looked forward to it. I'm a fisherman at heart. The boys are excited about it. But your mother is ailing, and you don't have an opportunity to see her very much. And that's important to you. What do? We talk. We listen to understand. We show empathy and respect for each other. I love you, and you love me. That causes us to be open and synergistic. See, synergy means the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. It's the relationship between the parts that represents a part in itself. And if habit 5 is exercised, that is, seek first to understand, help me to understand the importance of this, why we couldn't see your mother at another time or make a special trip or call her or phone her. And you say, help me to understand why it's so important that we go to this situation and do the fishing. We could have a very nice vacation by our mother and we could do some other things. And that's important. We don't know how long the mother will be around, and that's really more important than fishing. I can see that, but these boys are very important and they are so psyched about this, and we've given them those special fishing lessons. And we continue to talk back and forth with respect. We're looking for a win-win solution. Now, if I'm deep into authoritarianism, I might say, I don't really care what you think that much. When I want your opinion, I'll give it to you. We are going fishing, or I'll beat it out of you. Or if I'm into martyrdom, I might say, well, have your way with me. It's the way it always is. I always lose. In the former case, I'm into win-lose. In the latter case, I'm into lose-win. Or we could apply habits 4, 5, and 6, assuming we have an abundance mentality and enough internal security to carry on this communication, and say, let's agree to communicate until we can find a solution we both feel good about. Would you be willing? All right, let's do it. Let me listen to you first. I understand that visiting with your mother is so important because you haven't seen her for this, and here's your situation, and you can relieve your sister who's been taking care of her, and you keep expressing till the other person feels deeply understood. But you know what we've been doing with these boys and how much time and effort we've been given into these lessons, and they want to get into this fly fishing and it's just a perfect situation. And then I am understood. I am empathized too. And the spirit of mutual understanding creates such an affirmation, such a respect for each other. We're not going to go for win-lose or lose-win, nor are we going to compromise. We create new options, new alternatives in our minds. We find a lake near the mother. Maybe it's not as good as the lake we had prepared, but I feel much better about it because I respect my wife and I love her and I love her mother and want to attend to that important need in a way that would also meet my Boys need to have an expression of their fishing opportunity. It's a win-win solution. Is it compromise? No, it's a better solution. Some might say it's compromise. You really wanted to go to this lake. You're compromising. Not so. I really don't, because I care about my wife and I care about her mother. Neither is it a compromise to her. She doesn't want to see those boys just climbing walls while she tends her mother, takes care of her, has some good family visits. She'd like to see those boys involved in doing the thing they've been preparing to do. So they go for a win-win solution. Now, this little story could be amplified in any conceivable situation, my friends. Seriously. I am convinced that almost without an exception, if people practice 4, 5, and 6, they can take almost any difference and produce a third alternative better than either of the other two. I've done it too many times in negotiating proceedings, in team building, in legal battles and warfares, even with marriages that are broken. Get deep into habits 4, 5, and 6, listening, communicating with respect. Then use your creative capacities to produce options or alternatives that would have win-win benefits in them. It takes time. It takes patience. It takes habits 1, 2, and 3. It takes character strength. It takes the internal security that comes from being true to your own value system. Now, I'd like to go a little deeper into each of these three habits. Win-win is not just some cute expression. It is not a technique. It is not some cosmetic idea. Win-win is a total philosophy of life. It's the golden rule in action. And I suggest it embraces at least five dimensions. First, character, habits 1, 2, and 3. Second, the quality of the relationship, the emotional bank account. Third, the agreements that are made or the expectations that have been created. Fourth, how you organize structure and system to reinforce that win-win relationship and the win-win agreements. And fifth, the processes of how you do the other four, so that you cannot do it in a way that violates natural processes. Whether you like it or not, we're going to go for win-win. You can't do that. I might also say this. Not all agreements will be win-win. Not all decisions that will be win-win. The key thing is that relationship. You have a high emotional bank account with me, and you say to me, "Stephen, I know you won't like this decision. I don't have time to explain it to you, let alone get you involved. Will you support it? I know you think it's wrong. Will you support it?" You have a $200,000 bank account with me. Of course I would. I would hope you're right. I'm hoping I'm wrong. I'm going to make your decision work. Sometimes, because of situations and time, you have to behave in authoritarian or win-lose ways. I could even conceive of times when you might go for lose-win because of the emotional bank account in the relationship with the person. However, you don't behave in ways that take withdrawals from the emotional bank account, because that violates the relationship, which enables a win-lose decision to work, that gives you the flexibility to make it work. If you have an overdrawn emotional bank account and you say to me, "I know you don't like this decision, but will you sustain it?" I might say yes to your face, but behind your back, I'm going to torpedo that. And I'm going to do what I can to make sure others do too. It didn't work, did it? What do you want us to do now? Could be my attitude. Malicious obedience. I've lived 5 years in Great Britain. Twice I saw that country come to its knees because the train conductors were maliciously obedient in following the checklist of all of the rules and procedures written on paper. The only way that enabled those trains to arrive and leave on time is because people used their ingenuity, their creativity, their resourcefulness to do what's necessary to accomplish a result. So the key thing is the quality of the relationship, of which, of course, comes out of character. Can you imagine trying to build trust if you or I are not trustworthy? However, in the long run, you want to go toward win-win agreements, particularly when it deals with people's basic stewardships, their basic jobs, the basic thing that they are about, because they are very important, very jugular to them. Then you want to organize your systems to support that. For instance, what if innovation is important? You want to organize a system to reward innovation. What if cooperation is important? You want to set up a system to reinforce cooperation. One time I was in a business where the president asked me to help build a spirit of cooperation, and I said, "Is the problem in your people or in the systems?" He said, "Look for yourself. Test for yourself." Sure enough, you could feel a kind of selfishness, an unwillingness to cooperate, resistance, defensive communication. But I still pressed the question. I can see that there's an overdrawn emotional bank account there, low trust level. But is it because of people or systems? What is it you can do something about? He said, I think it's people. I looked up on his wall, and there was a curtain which he would open once a week, bringing all of the managers in front of it. And on the front of every horse on this horse race behind this curtain was the face of that manager. And over on the right side of the board was this travel poster of a beautiful Bermuda scene of a couple walking romantically, lazily down the beach, a white sand beach. So he'd bring them in front of that once a week and say, let's cooperate, help each other. We'll all make more money if we did this. Then he'd turn to the board, pull the curtain and say, who's going to make the trip to Bermuda? It's like saying to this flower over to your left, grow, grow, and watering the one to your right. It's like saying, firings will continue until morale improves. You need to have win-win philosophy built into your systems. You get into forced ranking, you get into normal distribution curving, and you're going to produce scarcity mentalities. In spite of all of the rhetoric around cooperation and innovation, you'll produce conformity and competition and defensiveness and interpersonal conflicts and interdepartmental rivalries, and these things are rife in many organizations. So win-win is a total philosophy, and all we can do in this presentation is to deal with it in a very simple way and to point out the various dimensions. There is so much more that if we had time, we could go into. Sometimes it appears as if you cannot work out a win-win deal. There's another alternative. It's called no deal. No deal. Don't hire the person. It's not going to be win-win. Work out a new job assignment. Go into outplacement services where the person can find a job that is win to them. Relocate. Reassign. Retread. Create new opportunities. Sometimes you go for no deal. We agree to disagree agreeably. I'll tell you the marvelous thing about the no deal option. You'll stop manipulating. Let's say you want something very bad in your business or in your family life. You want it real bad, okay? And it involves other people's cooperation. Just try it. Say to them, I only want to go for win-win. I want you to win and I want us to win. I would not feel good about it if we got our way and you did not win and feel good about it. Because downstream, that would haunt us both. It would be a withdrawal. And eventually, it would surface. But I don't think you'd feel good if you got your way and we didn't get ours. We didn't feel good about it. Let's say that it is a buyer's market and you're dealing with a vendor or a supplier. How easy it would be to go for win-lose. You'd get yours in a seller's market because you've taken a withdrawal. But how much more PC there would be in it if you said, what can we do to help you? You helped us come through struggling, tough times. We're going to help you. We're going to repay you for that. To where there was a great confidence given to you because of the emotional bank account has had so many deposits into it. Then say to the person, if we cannot work out this win-win deal, let's agree to disagree agreeably. Let's go for no deal. It's better. Then I don't have to have hidden agendas. I don't have to manipulate you. I can be very open. I can try to understand the deeper issues underlying your positions. I don't have to get into positional bargaining where we fight from each other's positions and we're each talking to our own constituencies. We can avoid that whole scenario. Let me see if I understand. What habit is that, my friends? 5. Seek first to understand. If we were to take the air out of the room that we're in right now, what would happen to our interest in this material? Well, obviously, we all know what would happen. We only want air. Now that we have air, does air motivate us? That's one of the great insights in the field of human motivation. It is only the unmet need that motivates. Once you have air does not motivate you. It's only the absence of air that motivates you. You know what the equivalent of air is in the field of communication? Habit 5. The deepest hunger of the human soul is to be understood. Once a person feels understood, they relax. Defenses are lowered. They become open. If the trust level is emotional bank account is overdrawn, they may not want to be understood. They don't know how you're going to use it. So you have to figure out other ways to make deposits. A deposit must be perceived by the other person as a deposit, not by you as a deposit. What you may think is a deposit is a withdrawal to them. That's why habit 5 is the key. You've got to get deep into their head, empathic, where you understand how they see it, how they feel about it. And they feel that you do. That's habit 5. That takes energy, tremendous energy. So much harder to listen in that kind of depth, with that kind of empathy, than it is to speak. There have even been machines put on people to test who's using the most energy. It's the listener. Always go prepared to listen. That's why your preparation is habits 1, 2, and 3. Integrity to your value system. The finest preparation you can make. Then you'll find in the very moment in which you find yourself, that preparation will come to your assistance and you'll be equipped and qualified in flexible ways to generate new alternatives, better alternatives, that had been thought of before. My friends, the only real test of win-win is when you're dealing with a win-lose person, or perhaps a lose-win person. That's the only real test. Many people say, well, you know, Stephen, I like this win-win idea. In fact, I had a man say that to me. He was the president of a large chain of retail store. He said, Stephen, I like the win-win idea, but it's idealistic. I'll bet a lot of you are kind of feeling like that. Tough, competitive business world isn't quite like that. He said that. I said, really? Try going for win-lose with your customer. Is that realistic? He said, well, no. Why not? I'd lose my customer. Then go for lose-win with your customer. Give away the store. Is that realistic? No. No margin, no mission. The only one that is realistic is win-win. He said, I better tell you my experience. That's true with customers, but not suppliers. I said, all you are is the customer of the supplier. Why doesn't the same principle hold? We're right now, he said, in the middle of renegotiating our lease arrangements with the mall operators and owners. You, as our consultant, counseled us to go for win-win. We did. We're open, reasonable, conciliatory, have a win-win attitude. They see that attitude as weakness and softness, and they took us to the cleaners. Immediately, I shot back. Why'd you go for lose-win? We didn't. We went for win-win. I thought you said they took you to the cleaners. They did. In other words, you lost. Yeah? And they won. That's right. What's that called? What he thought was win-win was really what? Lose-win. Being nice. Being nice guy. Nice guys finish last. Win-win is much tougher than win-lose. Far more rigorous than authoritarian behavior. Why? Because you have to not only be nice, you have to be courageous. You not only have to be empathic, you have to be confident. You not only have to be considerate and sensitive, you have to be brave. It's the balance between courage and consideration, the balance between self-respect and respect for others. That is the essence of habits 1, 2, and 3, which enable you to practice habits 4, 5, and 6. I hope you're beginning to sense the sequential nature of how these habits are organized and are inwardly becoming persuaded that you need to do the character work before you work on techniques and personality. You simply cannot harvest the crop if you have not planted in the spring, watered, weeded, and cultivated during the summer. There is no quick fix. When you emotionally accept that, you stop looking for them. And if you have a strong sense of mission and sense of values, you go to work. So much depends on the emotional bank account as to whether or not you can work out good win-win agreements. If it's a little overdrawn, if the trust levels are out there strained, possibly all you come up with is compromise, not synergy. Compromise means 1 + 1 = 1.5. Synergy means 1 + 1 = 3, 4, or 5. Most industrial disputes end up in compromise. Most legal suits end up in compromise on the courthouse steps. It's better than continuing the fight, obviously, because win-lose against win-lose produces lose-lose. And sometimes it's the only realistic thing. And you might, if you want to, call it a synergistic compromise. But the real essence of synergy is that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. As one put it, I want that window closed. I want it open, closed, open, closed, open. Look at the ego battle around that issue. People can invest their ego into their position, see? The key is to practice habits 4, 5, and 6. Why don't we communicate till we can find a solution we both feel good about? Habit 5, let me listen to you first. Why is it you want that window closed? Well, the draft blows my papers about. Then to be understood, why is it you want it open? I like the fresh air. I get a kind of claustrophobic feeling without it. Habit 6, synergize. What could we do to give the fresh air without the draft? We could open the window in the next room. It's a better solution. It's not a compromise solution. I think it's better, even though I wanted that window open, because I care about you. And the human relationship is certainly as important, if not more important, than the physical environment. However, if you're into an overdrawn emotional bank account to where you don't particularly care, then you are hung up on your positions. And you might call such a final conclusion a compromise. It all depends on that emotional bank account. So does your leadership style depend upon the emotional bank account? For instance, if you have an overdrawn one, how will you lead and supervise other people? Hover over, check up, follow through, direct. Isn't that right? Trust isn't there, so you got to control them. Otherwise, they could go wild. Now, what if the emotional bank account is high? What's your method? Get out of their way. As long as you have an upfront win-win agreement and they know exactly what's expected, all you have to do is be a source of help to them, to be a servant leader and to get out of their way. You still would hold them responsible for the commitment they made when you established the win-win agreement. Let me illustrate with a little family story. In a family meeting, we were all volunteering to do different jobs. We wrote down our goals, things we wanted to accomplish, things that were important to us, and then we asked who wanted to work on those goals. I was the only one with my hand up to pay the mortgage. Not one other person volunteered. When we first did this, my wife had a newborn. She was the only one that agreed to feed the newborn. No one else. And her job looked like a 60-hour week. My job was pretty heavy too. So when it came to the other jobs, everything was put into perspective.
A win-win agreement is an effective tool to clarify and manage expectations. It also creates a standard against which people can measure their own success. Stephen next outlines the five essential elements of a win-win performance agreement.
Now, here are the basic elements of a win-win agreement. You'd like to know how to get your kids to do their jobs cheerfully without being reminded? Take notes right now. You'd like to create a situation where your employees will be internally committed to what you want them to do? Take notes. You want that supplier to live by the agreement? Take notes. There are five basic elements to this win-win agreement, this performance agreement. First, desired results. What is it we want accomplished? Second, guidelines to work within, like values, even no-nos, things they should not do, things you know will fail. Identify them. Those are guidelines. Third, resources that they can draw upon to work within those guidelines to accomplish the desired results. Fourth, accountability, so that there is a strict sense of being accountable to accomplish those desired results, and when that accountability visit will take place, and what criteria will be used to indicate those results have been accomplished. Fifth, consequences. What things will result if the results are accomplished? That's where you would have your compensation system tied in there, or promotions, or psychic rewards, or where possibly you may have to give a new job, a smaller job, or perhaps a larger job. Plus, you have all of the natural consequences that happen you should identify if the job gets well done. How well it lubricates the whole business. How well it enables the entire family to accomplish its larger purposes. I know in our family mission statement, the first part of it reads like this. Our family mission is to create, notice the proactive language, to create a place of order, love, happiness, and relaxation, and to provide opportunity for each person to become responsibly independent and effectively interdependent in order to accomplish.
Welcome to tape 4 of the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. As Stephen next describes in his presentation of Habit 5, entitled Seek First to Understand, Then to Be Understood, learning how to communicate effectively and empathically is one of the master skills in life and is the key to building win-win relationships.
I'll tell you what the real challenge is in going for win-win performance agreements. It's the listening process in getting out how they really see it and how they feel about it. See, people have a lot of stuff in them, and you can't put new wine in old bottles. You've got to get it out. And often it takes time to build the emotional bank account before the trust toward you is high enough that they're willing to express themselves. That's why Habit 5, seek first to understand, then to be understood, is the essence of all professionalism. Habit 5 is the habit of communication. Seek first to understand, then to be understood. Can you imagine taking glasses off somebody and giving those glasses to somebody else? Well, let's try it for a second. I take your glasses, my friend. It's obvious you need new glasses, and I think you'll really like these. Like them?
No.
He liked them. Don't you like them? And don't they look good on him, everybody?
Yes.
They're tremendous. You wear them a while, you get used to them. Like them better?
No.
No? Try harder, my friend. This is the company way.
Still can't see.
Still can't see? A lot of negative spirit in that. Think positively. Nothing wrong with this program that a good positive attitude can't correct. Like them now? Yeah. Going to be part of this team? No. I can't believe your attitude. After all we have tried to do for you, son, your mother and I for many years have attempted to distill a few pearls of wisdom for your benefit. Like them now, son?
No.
No? You are the most ungrateful. Do you have any idea the kind of sacrifices that your mother and I have made for you?
Yes, sir.
Well, then be grateful and appreciative of what we've done for you. Like them now, son?
No.
Can you imagine the ingratitude of this generation? Thank you. See, the natural tendency in most people is to prescribe out of their own autobiographies. Let me tell you about my experience. Or let me tell you how I pulled myself up by the bootstraps. Let me tell you, see, they're prescribing their own glasses for other people rather than really deeply understanding what's happening inside other people and then prescribing based upon that diagnosis. Can you imagine the amount of security it takes to go into a deep listening experience where you don't know how it's going to end up? You do not know. You're on a Northwest Lewis and Clark expedition into those territories. You don't know where you're going to end up. Your security has to lie in your ability to accommodate and adapt to any given set of circumstances. Wild Indians, wild nature, weather, anything. You don't know. That's where habits 1, 2, and 3 provide that security. You're at peace, and you can inwardly flex and be adaptable to whatever the situation may bring. That's habit 5. Seek always to understand first. Study every profession. Medicine, obviously, has to diagnose before prescribing. In law, you have to study precedent and the case of the other attorney before you really develop your own. In engineering, you have to study the stresses and the forces that are at play before you design the bridge, the road. In teaching, you should pre-assess before you attempt to teach. In parenting, you need to understand. The other day, someone was giving an illustration of little PC toward his son. He was punishing his son for disobeying him and going around the corner. And he kept punishing him. The son kept going around the corner. Eventually, out of tear-filled eyes, the son looked the father in the eye and said, "But Daddy, what does corner mean?" See, the father did not seek first to understand the boy's level of understanding. He wasn't in the head of the boy. He was into his own head, projecting like home movies, projecting, this is the way you should think, this is the way you should feel. Sympathy is sometimes a very appropriate emotion. "Oh, I'm sorry, my friend. You've had that difficult experience and you've lost this loved one. I'm very sorry." Empathy is emotional and intellectual understanding of what the other person is feeling. Sometimes if you sympathize with a person, they'll feed on it and they'll never get out of it. Makes them dependent. Sometimes sympathy is the appropriate emotion. But if you empathize with a person, you get inside their frame of reference, see how they see it, how they feel it. You don't feel that way at all. You're not agreeing, you're not disagreeing. You're not even probing. Probing itself comes too much out of our own autobiographies. We take control when we probe. This is why many parents don't get close to their kids. They probe so much. "How's it going, son?" "Fine." "What's happening lately?" "Nothing." "What are your plans for this weekend?" "I don't know." "Son, don't you ever contribute to yourself around here? Do you live in a motel? All the things we do for you, we get 1 and 2 word answers, and we can't get you off the phone with your friends. Because you're probing. You can play 20 questions with people all day long and not find out what's important to them. Why? Your questions come from your own autobiography. In empathy, you listen with the eyes. You listen with the right brain more than with the ears. You listen for feeling, for meaning. You don't even need words to come back. You listen for behavior. You sense. You intuit. You feel. Then you can begin to have deep sensing, deep understanding of what's happening, and the basis to really know what would be an appropriate win-win approach. I had one father say to me, "You know, I can't understand my kid. He won't listen to me at all." Let me restate what I heard you saying. "You don't understand your boy because he won't listen to you." That's right. Let me restate it again. "You don't understand your son because he won't listen to you." That's right. What's your point, Stephen? "Well, I thought to understand another, you needed to listen to them." Oh, yeah. "Well, I already understand him. I mean, I've gone through it. I could tell you the things." Now, that's your autobiography. Do you listen from within the frame of reference of another? That takes not only skill, but emotional strength, which comes out of habits 1, 2, and 3. That's why most people cannot listen in depth. What are you risking if you deeply listen to another? You might be changed. And unless there is a changeless core about you, that is your integrity to your own changeless value system, you can't afford that risk. You don't know what's going to happen. People who act as if they don't care about other people's opinions care too much what other people think. That's why they're defending themselves against listening. Why? They're too vulnerable. They could be wiped out. What if they didn't like me? Where would I go and hide then? What would I do then? The real strength of the ability to practice habit 5 comes out of the first 3 habits. The ability to listen. And 4 and 6. 6 is merely the creative side of habit 5, where 2 people interact back and forth and produce new and better solutions. Most people, however, are scripted into fight or flight. Seriously, fight or flight. Take them on, fight them, give up, capitulate. Fight, flight. Both immature communication patterns. One of the two must develop the third alternative. Let me see if I can understand you first. Most people would say, well, I understand, but he or she won't try. You don't understand enough. There's reasons why the other person won't understand. There's psychological dynamics at play. And it doesn't take any big professional training. You don't become an amateur shrink or a psychoanalyst to figure out. You just simply try to listen from within the frame of reference of another. I hear you saying, I sense your feeling. Now that's hard, particularly when you think otherwise on a jugular issue with a person that's close to you. It's very hard, but you can do it. Why? Because your security does not come from the relationship. Your security comes from your integrity to your value system. I'd like to give you an experience for a moment. I'm going to split this room in half and show one picture to one side of the room and a different picture to the other side of the room. And then I'm going to show a third picture to both sides of the room. Okay? I'm purposely trying to script or program your heads. Okay? First, I'm going to show a picture to this side of the room right here. This side of the room, please close your eyes and look down. Now I'll show a different picture to this side of the room. Okay, you open your eyes over here, this side of the room, please close your eyes. Thank you. Now I'll show a third picture to both sides of the room. Everyone look at this one. When you first looked at this, the third picture, how many thought it was an old lady? Raise your hand. How many thought it was a younger woman? Raise your hand. I do this all the time, all over the country. And in 1 second of conditioning, it will split a room in half. There'll be a few exceptions. Those who were conditioned by the first picture to see the young girl would see the young girl in the third picture. Those conditioned to see the old lady would see the old lady in the third picture. Then I get them to interact with each other. Now, they are aware they've been programmed, so their interaction is far more respectful. Also, in some of our training programs, we haven't told them about being programmed. We've just included different pictures in their materials. So they were unaware of the scripting or the programming. And then when they interact with each other, that's when you see the sparks fly. What do you mean, old lady? She's lovely. She couldn't be more than 20, 22 years old. Oh, come on. You've left your tree. She's 70. She could be pushing 80. Really. Then you see the constant ego battles, and people invest their ego even more into it. It exacerbates the problem, and you discover one of the greatest insights in the field of communication, that 99% of all of the problems start with early misunderstandings. Why? Because we do not see the world as the world is. We see the world as we are. That first condition in experience causes us to interpret lines differently. The only fact you have up here is a line. What do you think it means? One says, that's the old lady's mouth. The other says, that's the young girl's necklace. That's called the aha experience, my friends. This is one reason why great consultants often say, effective executives don't go for facts, they go for opinion. It's opinion that gives meaning to facts. It's our prior experience that enables us to interpret these facts in different ways. Therefore, habits 4, 5, and 6 are the spirit of, let's talk it through, listen to each other, until we can see each other's point of view. And in this little demonstration are embodied habits 4, 5, and 6. Now, for those who have seen these pictures before, at any time, how many, when you looked at this picture here, saw the one you were originally conditioned to see? Raise your hand. Look around so you can get an idea of the number. How many saw the opposite of the one you originally conditioned? One person. The overwhelming majority were with a group that had been conditioned in a particular way. It teaches you something very powerfully. That first impression is going to lay inside the mind and heart of a person for years to come. And if I were to return here a year from today and show you this picture again, you would see the one you were conditioned to see back there when. There'd always be a few exceptions, but they're very few. We see the world as we are, not as it is. Most people don't really believe that, though. They think they see the world objectively. They see it as it is, that they're right, and that it is illogical for two to both be right and disagree. It is psychological. They're both right from within their own frame of reference. And if there could be that kind of respect given in the human communication, where they listen, practicing habit 5, seek first to understand, then to be understood, deposits be made in that emotional bank account, and you'd see two individuals who see it differently come to understand each other's point of view and produce the third alternative, the creative synergistic alternative that embraces the interests and the concerns and the objectives of both into a win-win agreement. were a win-win set of expectations. Never forget how powerful 1 second of conditioning is, particularly when you think about the years and years of scripting and conditioning with the people with whom you interrelate. That should teach us all a tremendous lesson that we should never forget. Teach us to be reverent and respectful and to seek first to understand. Now that takes character strength when the tendency, the need in most of us, is to seek first to be understood. I was back in Chicago, and it was a 2-day seminar on the fifth habit. I said, practice is at night. One guy came in the next morning and said, let me tell you what happened last night. I was in the hotel room. We were trying to cinch this real estate deal, a big institutional real estate deal, and the participants, the principals were there, their attorneys were there, and for the first time, another real estate guy was there. And it looked as if I was going to lose the deal. And I've been working on this now for many months, over 6 months. I've had no other income. In a sense, all of my eggs were in this one bushel, all of them, this one basket. And I didn't know, I was panicked. And I did everything I could to pull out the stops, to use every technique I could. And then I said to myself, I'm going to lose this deal. Why not practice what I learned today? Seek first to understand, then to be understood. So I stopped all of my techniques and manipulations and just said to the man, let me see if I can understand what your position is fully until you feel like I understand it. And then we'll see whether my proposal has any relevance or not. And he said to the man, I really want to understand. I sense your concerns are these. And the man opened up a little. Furthermore, I sense that you worry about this and that if you don't go in this direction, these kinds of things will resolve. Do I understand? More was opened up, more empathy expressed, until that person in the middle of our conversation said, excuse me a minute, stood up, walked to the other side of the room, picked up a phone, called his wife, turned around, and with his hand over the mouthpiece said, you've got the deal. He said, I was totally dumbfounded. I had no idea what had happened. I explained the dynamic is that if you meet the human need to be understood, you're also meeting the need to be appreciated. And people feel validated. They feel affirmed as a human being. And when it came right down to it, those human deposits were more important than the technical dimensions to the deal. And he became aware the kind of an investment, the effort, the energy you put into it over a long period of time, and it went in your favor. Even though technically it might have been better the other way. I have a friend who teaches at a university who feels like his research interests are out of the mainstream and never gets any money. I said, do the same thing. Go present your point of view fully, but you already have, they haven't accepted it, then listen to their point of view. Restate their position better than they can themselves, with such respect, with such completeness, such clarity, that they'll feel understood, appreciated, validated, and affirmed. He did it. And halfway through the presentation, the two senior professors turned to each other, said, Mark, you've got the money. Seriously, it is an absolute miracle principle, the fifth habit. We have full all-day seminars. I've done them on every one of these seven habits, all day on each one. The one most requested over all the years is the fifth habit, because it's so powerful.
Effective people know that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Next, Stephen discusses Habit 6, entitled Synergize, and how synergy results from valuing differences by bringing different perspectives together in a spirit of mutual respect.
One of the things you'll find when you communicate is that people think differently. You may have heard brain dominance theory. There's a lot to it. The left brain thinks differently than the right brain. It perceives differently. The left brain is the more verbal side. The right brain is the more visual. The left hemisphere is more analytical, more logical. The right is more creative, more intuitive. The left more time-bound. The right more time-free. And you need to have both. The key is the balance. Sometimes you don't have the balance in one person, you'll need it between two people. I was in a situation down in Orlando, Florida, talking on a seminar I present called Manage from the Left, Lead from the Right, suggesting that management, dealing with things, is more a left brain function. Leadership, dealing with people, is more of a right brain function. And the president of the company talked to me in the morning break and said, Stephen, I've been more interested in the application of that idea to my marriage than I have been to the business. I wonder if you'd had lunch with my wife and I. And just see how we talk with each other. Sure enough, he sat down and he began kind of pleasant conversation. What are some of the things, honey, you feel like I should be more considerate about and careful of? Notice the left side deals with parts, with facts. Listen to her right brain answer. Well, it's nothing specific. It's more of a general sense I have about priorities. Honey, I can't get a handle on that language. What do you mean by general sense about priorities? Well, I just don't think the marriage is as important to you as you keep telling me it is. Well, what do you want me to do? See the left brain pressing? I got to get a handle on something. It's nothing specific. Well, how can you expect me to do anything if you can't get specific about what it is? Well, it's a feeling. Honey, that's your problem. If you don't mind, that's also your mother's problem. In fact, it's the problem with every woman I know. Now get at it. What is it? She says, it's a strong feeling. You know, he looked at me with utter disdain for her. Like, Stephen, could you endure this much dumbness in your marriage? If you can't express it, it doesn't exist, right? Then he put her through a legal deposition. Do you live where you want to live? Oh, it's not that at all. I know, but since you won't tell me what it is, I'll find out what it is by finding out what it isn't. Do you live where you want to live? I guess. Honey, Stephen's here for just a few minutes trying to help us. Can't you just give simple yes or no answers? Do you live where you want to live? I guess. Just say yes. Yes. Okay. Do you have the things you want to have? I guess. Just say yes. You know, this went on for a little while. More withdrawals. I could see I wasn't helping at all. So I intervened and said, is that kind of how it goes? And he said, every day, Stephen. Looked at his wife and she said, it's the story of our marriage. I said, you two have kids? He said, yeah. Really? How'd you do that? How many did you have? Two? That's called 1 + 1 = 4. That's called synergy. How'd you do it? What do you mean, how do we do it? That's called creative. That's synergistic. Must have come from valuing the differences. The strength in relationships lies in differences for those who have an abundance mentality out of habits 1, 2, and 3. Otherwise, differences are threatening. They're competing and a source of comparisons. Don't clone people. Define unity not as sameness, but as complementariness. So he could appreciate her tremendous right brain capacities, and she could appreciate his equally tremendous left brain capacities and have a complementary team. That's what oneness is. It's not sameness, it's complementariness. That's a mature abundance mentality definition. Otherwise, you tend to think, since you're good with a hammer, that everything is a nail. That's Maslow's expression. He that is good with a hammer tends to think everything is a nail. They want to make other people over in their own image. Some people who think that everything is a nail are down on themselves because they're not a hammer. And they deprecate their own unique talents and capacities to use a chisel or a pair of pliers. Please hear what I am not saying. Did you hear what I just said? Please hear what I am not saying. You see, many people think they understand because they listen to what people are saying. But this person is saying, please hear what I am not saying. Don't be fooled by me. Don't be fooled by the mask I wear. For I wear a mask. I wear 1,000 masks. Masks that I'm afraid to take off, and none of them is me. Pretending is an art that is second nature with me, but don't be fooled. I give the impression that I'm secure, that all is sunny and unruffled with me, within as well as without, that confidence is my name and coolness is my game, that the waters are calm and that I'm in command, that I need no one. But don't believe it. Please don't. My surface may seem smooth, but my surface is my mask, my ever-varying and ever-concealing mask. Beneath lies no smugness, no coolness, no complacence. Beneath dwells the real me. See, these are the primary emotions. Beneath dwells the real me in confusion, in fear, in loneliness. But I hide this. I don't want anybody to know it. I panic at the thought of my weakness being exposed. That's why I frantically create a mask to hide behind, a nonchalant, sophisticated facade to help me pretend, to shield me from the glance that knows. But such a glance is precisely my salvation, my only salvation, and I know it. It's the only thing that can liberate me from myself, from my own self-built prison walls, from the barriers I so painstakingly erect. But I don't tell you this. I don't dare. I'm afraid to. I'm afraid your glance will not be followed by love and acceptance. I'm afraid that you'll think less of me, that you'll laugh, and that your laugh will kill me. I'm afraid that deep down inside I'm nothing, that I'm just no good, and that you'll see and reject me. So I play my games, my desperate pretending games, with a facade of assurance on the outside and a trembling child within. And so begins the parade of masks, the glittering but empty parade of masks, and my life becomes a front. I idly chatter with you in the suave tones of surface talk. I tell you everything that's really nothing, nothing of what's crying within me. So when I'm going through my routine, don't be fooled by what I'm saying. Please listen carefully and try to hear what I am not saying. What I'd like to be able to say, what for survival I need to say, but I can't say. I dislike the hiding, honestly I do. I dislike the superficial phony games I'm playing. I'd really like to be genuine, spontaneous in me. But you have to help me. You have to help me by holding out your hand, even when that's the last thing I seem to want or need. Each time you were kind and gentle and encouraging, each time you try to understand because you really care, my heart begins to grow wings, very small wings, very feeble wings, but wings. With your sensitivity and sympathy and your power of understanding, I can make it. You can breathe life into me. It will not be easy for you. A long conviction of worthlessness builds strong walls, but love is stronger than strong walls, and therein lies my hope. Please try to beat down those walls with firm hands, but with gentle hands, for a child is very sensitive, and I am a child. Who am I, you may wonder? I am someone you know very well, for I am every man, every woman, every child, every human you meet. All of us are very tender and sensitive inside, and the more inner security we can cultivate, the more we can listen to what people are not saying. Try it for yourself. Try it tonight. Try it with your loved ones. Say, I'd like to understand you. By the way, with your loved ones, you better tell them what you're doing, or they'll be very suspicious. You've never listened to me before. What's going on here? No. Say, today I listened carefully to some material on empathy and listening, and I realized, as I thought about our relationship, I haven't done that very much. I've been rather critical and judgmental. I need to do that. I'm going to try. I'm going to try to restate your position to your satisfaction. And then do it. Watch what begins to happen. Can you see why that takes character strength? Why it takes patience? Why it takes habits 1, 2, and 3?
The key to the ongoing practice of the 7 habits is sharpening the saw regularly within the 4 dimensions of our personalities, which include the physical, the mental, the spiritual, and the social-emotional. Stephen begins this side by explaining why Habit 7, entitled Sharpen the Saw, is essential to combat the inevitable effects of complacency and stagnation.
You know what the basic ability to cultivate these 6 habits is? It's the 7th habit. It's the one you've been waiting for. It's the habit that if you do it right, you do it completely, regularly, it will automatically develop the other 6. It's the maintenance habit. It's the habit of personal PC. Just envision in your mind coming across someone who's sawing down a tree, really going at it vigorously. And you come up and you say, what have you been doing? Can't you see I'm sawing? I know, but how long? Oh, I don't know. I've been at this for hours. I'll bet you're tired. Oh, you can't believe. Well, why don't you sharpen the saw? Too busy sawing, dumb. That's the 7th habit. Take time to sharpen the saw. Sharpen the saw regularly. You ever been too busy driving to take time to get gas? There are 4 dimensions of the human personality, and you'll find all 6 habits involved in the sharpening of these 4 dimensions. There's the physical, the spiritual, that's your value system, the mental, and the social-emotional. I put those 2 together because our emotional maturity is manifested in, and to some degree, a fruit of, our relationship with others. Those are the 4 dimensions. To sharpen the saw means basically to exercise all 4 dimensions and to organize your life so that you have time in quadrant 2 to do that. 1 hour a day, minimum, will, I believe, maintain these other 6 habits. To really get good at those 6 habits, it takes more than that. What does this involve? Physical exercise. The best kind is stretching and aerobics and a little muscle toning, kind of a combination of the 3. Aerobics is the kind of exercise that deals with the cardiovascular system, the respiratory system, which enlarges the capacity of the body to process oxygen. And that's the key to energy as well as interest. Stretching should precede or follow briefly the aerobics. Muscle toning, like calisthenics or weights or things of this nature, also are helpful. And if people can cultivate a habit of at least 30 minutes every other day, they can maintain. To really enlarge the capacity of the body to work, they may have to do just a little more. But as they do, even a half an hour, the body becomes more efficient, the heart muscles stronger, more oxygen is pumped through the body, and they have more vitality, more energy inside. So I commend to you to make your mind up. If you do not now have a good exercise program, to start one. A little stretching, then go on a vigorous walk, or a jog, or a bike, or a swim, but a good vigorous walk for, say, 20 minutes. And then a little stretching at the end and a few calisthenics. And you've got a minimum physical exercise program. What if you only spent 3 hours in a week? Of a week that's made up of 168 hours? Is that disproportionate with the only instrument you've got? I think it's better to try to give about an hour a day, every day of a week. But at least give a half an hour every other day, or 4 days a week. With regard to spiritual exercise, That involves habit number two. That's where you renew your commitment to your well-developed value system. You do it in a way that is congruent with your own philosophy. It's done differently. Some people read important literature, even sacred literature. Other people meditate, pray, think deeply about key fundamental issues. This kind of, we could call, spiritual activity is providing leadership, habit two. Then the mental planning and doing in staying with that leadership is habit three. So you visualize and plan your roles and goals for that week and then review it for each day to make sure that your life is in harmony with your mission and your overall long-term roles and goals. That's the mental habit, the mental creation, habit two and three. The spiritual creation is habit two. The mental creation is part of habit two because you're still planning and thinking, but it's also having the mental toughness to stay with it in habit three when perhaps there are distractions and temptations that would lead you to capitulate and to give in to lesser important items, items of low priority. The social-emotional sharpening the saw embrace habits four, five, and six so that you say to yourself, I'm going to approach this relationship with a win-win attitude. I'm going to seek first to understand. Then I also want to be understood. But I will not seek to be understood until the other feels like I understand. And then I'm going to get into creative problem solving with that person. Synergize to see if we can come up with better solutions than what originally we proposed to each other. Come up with a better psychological agreement. Those are the four basic dimensions of the human personality that basically express and develop all of the other habits. If it's well done in a balanced and regular way, it will do exactly that. We had a child one time that we were very concerned about. It seemed that this child was kind of incapable in many directions, social, athletic, academic. And I was teaching at that time this material on perception and communication, how our head creates our world. And I said to my wife, Sandra, isn't it possible that this child is greatly a function of our picture, our image? Isn't it possible that our paradigm is producing the behavior? We explore deeply this whole issue, particularly by sharpening the saw through this spiritual and mental creation process. It took time. We had to explore our own motives. It's easy to get social mileage out of your kid's good behavior. We had to see how much we really had intrinsic sense of respect and love for this child. Slowly, almost imperceptibly, we gained a deeper understanding and awareness and insight into this child and acted accordingly. And little by little, also almost imperceptibly, you could begin to see the effect it had. See, most people's map of themselves, paradigm of themselves, is a function of the social mirror, particularly with the significant people of their life. And if those people will change that mirror because they have a deeper, better understanding, other people will internalize that picture and behave accordingly. It started to go at such a rapid clip that it far exceeded the normal developmental processes of maturation as described by the experts in that field. In a sense, it was sharpening the saw as applied to building a relationship and the confidence and the esteem of a child. So let's resolve never to get too busy. We don't take time to sharpen the saw.
Stephen next explains why every habit is a paradigm shift, representing a break from traditional wisdom and culture. He also explains the relationship the seven habits have to each other and how the habits apply to both individuals and organizations.
Now we move to the third part, which will be a short part, in reviewing all that we have covered and to put it in the larger context of paradigms. I suggest, my friends, my listeners, that every habit is a paradigm shift. Let me show you. Take how we define, first of all, effectiveness as the P-PC balance. See, most people define success almost entirely focused upon P, getting the golden eggs. So that itself is a paradigm shift. Habit number one, be proactive. The traditional popular paradigm is you're not responsible. You're a product. You're a program. Habit two, begin with the end in mind. The traditional paradigm is that you're acting out of the scripts given to you, that you're really not in charge, and that goal setting is useful and helpful, but usually not resulting in great accomplishments because of all of the other forces that play upon your life and keep you from accomplishing those goals. Habit number 3, put first things first. You'll find that most people are surrounding the paradigm of quadrant 1. They're always prioritizing into checklists the crises and the problems of their life. That is an action paradigm they're into, whether they believe it or not. Throw away simple calendars, throw away appointment books, and instead write your mission, your roles and goals, have a long-term appointment calendar where you can on a weekly basis transfer that information and how you're going to accomplish those goals in each of the roles to a weekly thing, and then have the mental toughness and the discipline to stay with it unless a more important thing, like a person's need, supersedes. Habit 4, think win-win, is so deeply counter to the win-lose scripting programming of most people's lives. Habit 5, seek first to understand, then to be understood, is the opposite of the tendency, which is so strong in us, of seeking first to be understood. And habit 6 is usually defined as compromise. Very few people have experienced what synergy is really like. It's a whole new world. It's a world of adventure, excitement, creativity, new options, new opportunities, whole new ways of thinking are manifested in that habit. Just as Einstein put it, the significant problems we face cannot be solved at the same level of thinking we were at when we created them. Let's look now at habit 7. It itself is a paradigm shift. You know what the normal operational paradigm that exists out there? First of all, it's not balanced. It doesn't focus on all four dimensions. It may focus only on the physical one, so people are into exercise, or perhaps on the mental one, so they become readers of books, or it may focus only on the spiritual one, so people withdraw into the wilderness in deep meditation. The key is balance between all four dimensions, and that is the paradigm we are advocating here. A balanced one, also one that requires constant attention, I mean daily attention, to all four dimensions. Second, I'd like to emphasize the sequential nature of these habits. How 1, 2, 3, or what I call the private victory, the character victory, leads to 4, 5, 6, the public victory, the personality victory. And to not confuse or to invert that process, it will not take place that way any more than you can harvest crops you have not sown. Even inside each group of habits, you must have a sense of personal awareness, personal vision, habit 1, before you'll even attempt to provide leadership and management, habits 2 and 3. You must have a desire to go for win-win before you'd even want to listen and to communicate and to go for synergy in habits 4 and 5. Third, I suggest that the synergy or the relationship between the habits is the power of the 7 habits. It's the way they serve each other. See, I have to be very proactive before I can seek first to understand. I have to be very proactive before I'll work on quadrant 2. I have to have a real sense of mission, habit 2, before I would be able to know exactly what kind of a win-win agreement would be a win for me. Fourth, I suggest all of these habits apply to organizations as much as to individuals. We work with literally hundreds of organizations all over the country. And organizations that are highly proactive are making their own futures happen. For instance, a while back, I was in a 3-day conference of an association of businesses that were undergoing some very serious setbacks in the industry, including massive unemployment. They were very depressed and blue. The very first day of the conference, they focused on what was happening to them, and they were depressed. The second day, they focused on the future trends. They were more depressed. Things were going to go worse, not better. The third day, they focused on the proactive question. What are we going to do about it? How are we going to better manage and control our costs and increase our revenues? And they gave their creative energies to that. At the end of the 3-day conference, we came up with a kind of brief verbal motto that symbolized that 3 days. Someone comes up and says, "How's business?" The answer is given in 3 parts. Part 1, what's happening to us is not good, and the trend suggests it will get worse before it gets better. Part 2, but what we are causing to happen is very good, for we are better managing our costs and increasing our revenues. Part 3, therefore, my friend, business is better than ever. That's the proactive response of a business that is in charge of its own destiny in a relatively hostile environment. How does a business do habit 2? It develops a mission statement, a purpose statement, a value system that everybody is involved in its formation. What's habit three? It lives accordingly. It uses that as the criteria by which everything else is evaluated. What's habit four? In all of its relationships, it thinks win-win. Mutual benefit. Suppliers, employees, owners, managers, the public. Of course it takes social responsibility. It doesn't need to get into collective resistance, different forms of social legislation to force people to do what is right. As Patrick Henry once said, he that does not govern himself wisely will be governed by despots. The greatest way to lose our liberties is to exercise our freedom irresponsibly. What's habit five to a business? Understand the customer. Understand first before you design products, before you sell services. Understand. Understand your people, your employees, before you know how to organize the culture, to try to influence the culture. Then seek to be understood. Then seek to have influence. Diagnose before you prescribe. And what's habit six? Synergize. Get deeply involved with your customers and understanding their needs. Come up with creative new solutions. And if you help produce it with them, they're highly influenceable by you. In fact, it will test your professional integrity because they'll do about anything you tell them to. Just like someone who had confidence in their doctor would do anything the doctor told them to do. And what is the self-renewal habit, the sharpening the saw habit of organizations? What does an organization do to renew itself? It has to rethink all of its operations against the higher criteria of change out there in the environment and of the mission statement, so that the spirit of entrepreneurship and innovation is kept alive. It has to fundamentally ask this question: if we did not have this practice, if we did not have this policy, if we did not have this product, would we adopt it today? That takes courage. And to move away completely from the expression, that's the way we've always done it. Next time someone says that, ostracize them and haunt them for 48 hours. In other words, my friends, these are habits of life for people and organizations. They are the embodiment of principles, natural laws, that will hold over time for people and organizations. A principle is a natural law. A practice is its expression in a particular circumstance. For instance, let's say that you have the principle of serving the customer well. A practice may be to listen carefully to what the customer wants and give him that particular thing. But in another situation, you don't have access to knowing what the customer wants. So you may have to do some research to understand generic needs out there of customers and then adapt to that. The point is that anytime you work with principles, you work with natural laws, but they express themselves in a number of different ways in different circumstances. For instance, you may be in a situation where the natural law that is operating is to treat this particular employee with great courtesy and respect. But let's say the situation is such that that employee is violating the value system of the organization. Maybe the most respectful way you can deal with that employee is to carry out the agreed upon consequence of his losing his job or being transferred to a lower position, because you operate on the principle of helping people and you're helping that person learn accountability. Where other people may have let him off the hook in the name of being a nice guy, but really ends up with lose-win. The key is to gear our life around principles and then let everybody sense from their conscience what the appropriate practices are in different situations. If you teach people practices, you make them dependent. You say to a new employee, do this, do this, do this. Now what happens when the change comes? They're looking to you again. They're dependent upon you. There's no PC in it. You give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. You teach him how to fish, you feed him for a lifetime. Teach principles and let people govern themselves in selecting the practices. Arnold Toynbee, the great historian, says that the whole history of mankind's institutions and societies themselves can be summarized in a simple little formula: challenge, response. The challenge is external, the response is internal, it comes back. If the response is equal to the challenge, it is success. If the response is obsolete because of a new change, even though it once applied and once worked, it will lead to failure. Nothing fails like success. You ever tried to raise child number two like you did child number one and wonder why it didn't work? You have a totally different challenge. That's why if you operate on principles, not practices, the principles will always stay no matter what the circumstance is. But the practices will vary all over the place. What happens with organizations is, if they are not grounded into a changeless set of core values and a mission statement that tells what they're about, you'll find that they will tend to rigidify and freeze systems and structures that become obsolete. But once worked, old procedures, old policy manuals, people live in memo haven. They're inundated by old things that are now totally obsolete. The key is to get the entire culture around a mission statement and a set of values. Then you don't have to supervise them. They supervise themselves. It's moving from the paradigm of control to the paradigm of commitment and release. Fifth, let's be patient and practice. As one put it, let's not keep pulling up the flowers to see how the roots are coming. It takes patience because we're in the law of the harvest. We're into natural laws. It's important that we realize we don't have to be perfect in habits 1, 2, and 3 before we can go to work on habits 4, 5, and 6. We're working every day on habits 4, 5, and 6. All I suggest is we will not be truly effective with habits 4, 5, and 6 unless we achieve a little higher degree of self-mastery and internal security, which are the fruits of habits 1, 2, and 3. Particularly, let's get more and more into quadrant 2. Where all these seven habits live. Spend time there. If you're only there 10%, get there 15, then 20, then 30. Watch what begins to happen to quadrant one. Watch what begins to happen to your level of excitement, to the quality of your relationships, and to your self-confidence, and the spirit of adventure and excitement and happiness that were the promised results that we indicated we could expect if we truly learned, taught, and applied these habits. Regarding this process of living out of quadrant two, there is an outstanding book called Connections, written by Roger and Becky Merrill, that would give a great deal of specific, helpful direction, ideas on how to realistically live in quadrant two, how to use time tools well so that they serve you well, and also a great deal of useful information and motivation on how to write a mission statement. A statement of purpose and philosophy and values.
Next, Stephen shows how working within our circle of influence is the only way we can effectively produce desired results and influence others.
One final point that, in a sense, summarizes it all and tells us where to start. I want you to envision in your mind two circles. The inner circle is called the circle of influence, and the outer circle is called the circle of concern. It is a much larger circle. It may be 10 times as large. The inner circle are those concerns over which you have direct influence, direct control. If you think through all seven habits, you'll come to realize there's only one place to go to work, and that's where? The inner circle of influence, things over which you have direct control, because the nature of that energy is proactive. It's value-driven. It's positive. And positive energy energizes things, lifts things, enlarges them, magnifies them, and the inner circle gets larger and larger and larger. Just last night, I read the story of an individual who did this, and in a matter of 1 year, had 5 advancements. Simply by trying to anticipate, what is it I can work on? And go to work on that with real energy and fervor and excitement. I had another friend who worked for a very dictatorial leader whose style alienated everybody, and everyone would stand in the executive corridors and badmouth him and validate each other. But this man was highly proactive and value-driven, and he anticipated needs, and he would not only be a good golfer, as the president wanted, he would go the second mile, he would do more than what was necessary, he would read the president's need, diagnose the problem, give his recommendations based upon it, and make the material so the president could use it for his own presentations. One day the president said, "Stephen, I am totally amazed at this man. I have such confidence within him. Look what he has done." Next meetings, he treated everyone like a gopher. Gopher, gopher, gopher this, gopher this, gopher this. "Ben, what's your opinion?" It's Ben that enlarged his circle of influence, not the president. Your power to influence is a function of you, not of other people denying you access. Just work within the present circle of influence with positive energy, these habits, and watch what begins to happen. Try it for 30 days. Be a light, not a judge. In your home, try it. In your marriage, try it. Be a model, not a critic. Just try it. Uncommitted people couldn't make it through a night. They are absolutely bound and determined to transfer responsibility and to find fault outside themselves, so they spend most of their time confessing other people's weaknesses and sins. Do it for 30 days. Get a habit of it. Work only in the inner circle of influence. That doesn't mean you're stepped on. That's lose-win. You may be very courageous in your confronting. You may have to do a great deal of empathy before you make that presentation, that courageous presentation. But go to work on it. See what begins to happen. I'll guarantee it will revolutionize relationships for good. On the other hand, if you give your energies to the outer circle of concern, you'll find the inner circle will wither. Why? Because you're neglecting it. And the nature of the energies of focusing on things out there, outside your circle of influence, is negative. Negative energy shrivels and withers the things it neglects. Remember this, if you ever think the problem is out there, that very thought is the problem. If you ever think that the problem is with somebody else or with a circumstance, that very thought process is the problem. The significant problems we face cannot be solved with that kind of thinking, at the same level of thinking we were at when we created them. Emotionally accept, you can go to work inside the inner circle of influence. In many ways that are outside your own present job. But your job may overlap into the circle of concern you can do nothing about. Don't complain. They've given me responsibility without authority. They're holding me responsible for results beyond my control. Just work in the areas you know you can help other people be facilitated. We all know ways we can frustrate people's work if we have the mind to. We also know creative ways we can facilitate other people's work if we have the mind to. Do it for 30 days. Test it for yourself to see if you don't feel a new excitement. It'll put you through your proactive muscle development, I'll guarantee you. It'll cause you to think about your mission and to execute around that mission. It'll cause you to spend time in quadrant two. And you'll need to use habits 4, 5, and 6 if you're going to be effective with other people. Remember this, if you ever make a presentation, describe the other person's point of view better than he or she can then.